Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, Episode 9. And tonight, we're talking about September 15th through the 21st, 1993. We haven't hit 1993 yet, and this is a pretty big week. So, with me tonight, of course, is my co-host, who's now become the Keith Olbermann of professional wrestling internet jobs, as he bounces from here and there and everywhere. And he'll talk about his new job, I'm sure, later on. David Bix is fan. Bix, what's going on?
No, I'm a freelancer. I'm like Suzuki.
Yeah, I'll say. I mean, it seems like every week you got a new job. So,
in a good way, though.
Yeah. As long as you have work, so that's all that matters. But I'll let you talk about that later when we do
it's
the plug.
It's not like I'm burning people. I'm just working for different places, many at the same time.
Yeah. You are a jack of all trades. And on the other end of the line is a guy that works for a place that Bix used to work at, K-Side Seats. And that is our dear friend from the UK, Keith Harris. Keith, what's going on?
Well, I'd happily have the Bix back, but I don't make those decisions. But I'm sure, really glad that I started out working underneath him.
Thank you. Those things have softened, though. I mean, there's no longer any heat with me with anyone there, which is good, which I'm happy about.
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
So. Well, that's what we need. We need more harmony in the wrestling internet world.
Oh God, yes.
Because there's a lot of backbiting and all that type of stuff, but that's a whole nother show. Tonight, let's get back to what we're talking about here, and that's Between the Sheets 9, September 21. Oh, wait a minute, wrong day. September 15th or 21st, 1993. Wow. And we're going to start off with the WWF, because we ended with WWF last show, and it just fell perfectly to lead off with on this show, as there's some big doings behind the scenes this week in WWF, as the Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion Shawn Michaels has walked out of the company for the first time on September 15th after a dispute with management due to his unhappiness with how he was being portrayed. Shawn demanded a full release so he could work where he wanted to, but the company wouldn't give him what he wanted, so he upped and quit. Michaels was supposed to defend his title against the 1-2-3 Kid on shows in North Charleston and Florence, South Carolina, as well as Augusta, Georgia, over the weekend. And Kid was forced to work with Bastion Booger instead. Oof. A source told The Observer that Michaels said he had been unhappy with the promotion, which caused him to gain weight and get out of shape. Quote, "When I was in Detroit for SummerSlam, Michaels was looking for beer late at night, saying he has a 2-drink minimum before he goes to sleep. The feeling around," unquote. "The feeling around most in the promotion is that Michaels will come back, but it will be months down the road. Meanwhile, Diesel's status is now uncertain because he will remind people of Michaels not being there. Michaels would eventually be stripped of the title, forcing a battle royal on September 27th in New Haven, Connecticut, on the Raw tapings, with Razor Ramon and Rick Martel being the last two men in the battle royal and meeting in the final match that night, which aired, I think, a week or two later on Raw. And, of course, Razor winning and becoming a champion. A couple of weeks later, a friend of Shawn Michaels told The Torch that Michaels, after missing several of his scheduled appearances, came to agreement with Vince McMahon to take about 3 months off from wrestling. Michaels felt overworked and was burned out from the pressures of life on the road. McMahon was accommodating when he realized Michaels' feelings. McMahon is also known as one who likes to turn what appears to be a bad situation into a benefit to the company. Look for an eventual Michaels return when and if it occurs to be well-plotted and effective. Any independent appearances by Michaels in the next few months would be a surprise." Now, this is what was covered at the time. Now, after the fact, we've received, all kinds of different varying stories. Michaels in shoot interviews and in his first book talked about a bad steroid test.
False positive,
although he said he never did steroids at the time. And we've had other things about he was no showing and got suspended. I mean, we never really got the truth, Keith, but this was the first big blow up between Michaels and Vince. And he came back and he still had his Intercontinental title, and Razor had his Intercontinental title, and they had the two belts. And led to their ladder match, and it worked out in the end. But yeah, this is the beginning of whiny Sean.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, I think. So firstly, was he really being used that badly at the time? He was Intercontinental Champion. I could see after SummerSlam where he beat Kurt Hennig by count out due to Diesel's interference. You know, he was a bit aimless, you know, coming out of SummerSlam because, you know, Diesel was getting to work with Hennig next. And Sean was pulling a feud with the 1-2-3 Kid, who had just lost to Erwin R. Scheister on the at SummerSlam. So I could see Shawn Michaels perhaps being a bit unhappy with that. But then Sean Waltman is obviously one of Sean's friends. So, you know, it's just interesting how it was, you know, how it was framed in the, you know, the sheets at the time. Because it doesn't quite add up, you know, that story on its own.
Well, I don't know how deep the friendships were yet. Because, yeah, you know, Kevin Nash has just got there not too long before. I'm sure, you know, Sean and Scott, you know, had been buddied up by now. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, it wasn't all there yet. But, yeah, you're definitely right about how 1-2-3 Kid was being portrayed. Because he had that the win over Ramon and got a push off that. And now he's jobbing the IRS on SummerSlam. The Sean Hennig match, from what I remember, was not that great of a match. Sean, yeah, if physically at this time period, had gained, I mean, he had gained weight. He was pudgy.
As Punky used to say, chubby babyface Shawn Michaels. Chubby bad guy Shawn Michaels.
Chubby bad guy Shawn Michaels. He, and Sherry's gone. So, I mean, it seemed like he was stagnant, Bix. Wouldn't you agree that, you know, when they turned him, you remember, he got the world title shot at Survivor Series 92 against Brett. But it just seemed stagnant for, you know, after the Marty feud. Yeah, on the few months, he was just stagnant.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Did he have any program at all after
Duggan?
Hennig moved? No, I mean after Hennig moved on to Diesel.
The Hennig program was it, pretty much. I mean, he had that small feud with Duggan.
Oh, right, because we're still only a couple weeks after SummerSlam.
He had that small feud with Duggan before, which had that the lumberjack match and all that stuff.
Which was actually very good.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, Duggan's probably last great moment in the company. But, yeah, I mean, aimless is the right word, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I can see why he kind of thought he wasn't going anywhere, but I mean, Kid had only been there for a few months, though, so if they were trying to build him up, I mean, I don't know. I think that would have been a good feud. I can sort of see why, in terms of the pecking order, he sort of thought it might have been a bad idea. Especially if he had a feeling that he might lose at the end, but I think if that's the case, he's kind of overreacting.
Yeah, and well, there's Shawn Michaels. You know, I mean, overreacting and Shawn Michaels go hand in hand over the years. And you look at the heel roster of WWF at the time period. I mean, Yokozuna is cleared number one, but after that, it's a drop off, a huge drop off. I mean, you look at Sean and then Martel and IRS and guys like
Doink. Although that's about to change. They had taped that already, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So Ludwig Borga, you know, is there. It's not a dynamic group behind Yokozuna. And the babyface is heavy with Brett and Luger and
Undertaker.
And Savage was working house shows.
You do have Bigelow on the heel side, but they just weren't using him right.
Yeah. It was just an odd time in the WWF, and I just think Sean thought he was, you know, had his wheels being stuck, and you look at WCW at the time, and there's all kind of young guys that's getting pushed, and he's thinking, well, I mean, this could be a great place for me to go if he's trying to leave.
Well, so. You know, a lot of the young guys that they were starting to push were very green. They weren't looking to spend a lot of money, but I suppose we'll get to that, you know, at Fall Brawl. But one thing I could see, you know, with Ludwig Borger coming in, not a very good worker, very campy gimmick, I could see Shawn Michaels being upset that he was getting the big push to face Lex Luger instead of him, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. See, and that would have been the old school WWF way of doing business, is if you're moving Luger off of Yokozuna, you always put him on the IC champion next. You know, that's how the way it goes. The face moved off the heel to the next lowest face, and vice versa. So,
but instead, at least on TV, though, Luger was still sort of feuding with Yokozuna, even though he couldn't get a title shot.
Yeah. So yeah. Why not just move him on? Or you know, Razor is he is turned face by this time, right? Wouldn't he have babyface at this time?
Yes.
Here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a feud, a feud right there.
Yep.
That is a little weird. Like, why? Because also, Razor didn't have a program coming out of SummerSlam in the first place.
Exactly. And then they put him with Martel, and that was the program off that for a short time here. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's just a weird era of WWF. And this is when, you know, a lot of stuff is starting up, you know, regarding the steroid trial, too.
Well, didn't the indictment come down like. Well, no, the indictment came down when? November?
Yeah, so I mean,
but there were articles about that it was it being impending and stuff like a week or two after this.
Yeah, so you know, there's sharks in the water, so there's a lot of uncertainty going on. But yeah, I mean, it's just, and I did like that. I did like the double belt feud. I thought that was a cool touch because they had never done anything like that before, and you know, you had the two champions. Sean's belt was. Was it the white belt?
I think by the time he came back, I don't remember if he still had the white strap. By the time he came back, it was two black strap belts, I think.
Okay. Because I seem to remember, though, at first it was two different strap colors.
It might have been at first.
To differentiate the titles.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? No, you're right. Because they did at least one or two Coliseum video matches where they did Michaels run in fake title changes, and one of them, I think the Ludwig Borger one, has him holding up the white belt.
Yes.
Okay.
And when Shawn came back, he was still pudgy, Shawn Michaels. So he didn't lose the flab. But yeah, I mean, what was the story, Keith, that you were talking about yesterday when we were talking about the show? Was him and Kevin Nash, what were they doing on the road, drinking?
So in his book, he was saying that, you know, he was drinking a case of beer with Kevin Nash every night and matching him meal for meal. And he also said, like, why should I, of anyone in the promotion, need to use steroids? And, you know, and how could I be using steroids because, you know, I'm fat and out of shape? And I don't really buy that reasoning, given that we know from, you know, following wrestling that there are people who you wouldn't think would be using steroids because they do look out of shape or they're not particularly ripped, but they, you know, were using at the time because there was this pressure on everyone to be bigger, you know, in size. You know, not just necessarily ripped muscles.
Right.
And the other thing is, if you're doing all this drinking, you know, then, you know, that's going to get you out of shape. You might need help to try and, you know, try and keep your physique up.
Yeah, it's a beer belly for a reason is what it's called. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, with what we're talking about, too, I mean, there was one wrestler that I won't name that, you know, after the Benoit stuff went down, who was not, was one of the one guy, maybe the one guy in WWE whose gimmick was being kind of fat, or at least, you know, by WWE standards, who got smaller as soon as they started testing everyone more strictly again.
Amazing.
Yeah. You guys both remember what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah, so you can
read between the lines, everyone. But that wasn't the only disciplinary issue in WWF this week, as Matt Bourne, who was working as Doink the Clown, was suspended for 6 weeks on the same day as Sean's walkout for unprofessional conduct, quote unquote, over what was presumed as a failed drug test. Steve Lombardi will be taking over the Doink gimmick immediately and has had experience in the gimmick working as a fake Doink earlier in the year. He was Doink number 3 at one point. Steve Kern was Doink number 2, and he had just been fired a week or two before this. So Matt Bourne, Bix, he quite the troubled life he had. It messed him up in wrestling for many years. Hell of a talent when he was on. He could cut promos. He could work. Just a great guy. Great guy in the ring. But yeah, his own worst enemy was himself.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's drugs or just everything else too. I mean, you guys saw it when I tweeted that thing a couple weeks ago. Like, I was looking for the Snuka clippings from when Nancy Argentino died and from the hotel arrest a few months before. And I'm looking, and like around the same time was Matt Bourne being arrested for, I don't want to have to go look it back up again, but what was it? There was a woman and her daughter who were fans were helping him bring his bags back to his room, right?
The daughter, they
were done, the mom, or almost done, the mom walked out of the room, he slams the door, locks the daughter in. I believe the word they used was molested.
Why he got fired from Georgia.
Which led to the Road Warriors getting the titles.
Which led to the creation of the Road Warriors.
Yeah, and I'm trying to. He's just, there are all sorts of stories and stuff. I mean, just very, very troubled guy.
And it's odd because you look. I mean, we hear these same stories from Mark Barr and Matt Bourne, and these are sons of famous Pacific Northwest guys, and there's so much similarity between those two. It's amazing. And Matt Bourne, he had troubles in Japan, issues over there with being caught with drugs. He was in, he spent a lot of time in Texas, which he was able to get away with it there because everybody was on drugs in Texas at World Class at that time period. Now, I will say this. When he went to WCW as Big Josh, that was probably his best career run. Maybe not as far as work.
Discipline.
But discipline and being consistent. Because he was there for like a year and a half. So.
And he got there earlier than people remember because he came in, it was like late 90 or early 91?
Early 91 as Tommy Rich's friend for the Northwest.
Right.
He stayed till mid to late 92.
Yeah, when did him and Simmons get the U.S. tag titles?
Yeah.
He left not long after that, right? And then he immediately became Doink.
And then became Doink, and there is no other Doink the Clown than Matt Bourne. Matt Bourne was so awesome in that role. And, Lombardi or whoever else they put in it, could not touch him. He made that character.
Well, it was perfect. What I was thinking just now was, it's almost a perfect gimmick for one of those like guys who grew up in the Northwest or as Piper fans who imitated Piper type. That's a perfect gimmick for that type of guy to sort of do the type of shtick they like to do without outright being a Roddy Piper imitation. You know what I mean? That's kind of part
and
of
can
why
you talk
it
about how the Go ahead. And keep talking about evil Doink. You know, people think about Doink as, with Dink and all the other little Doinks and stuff like that, but evil Doink was quite disturbing when he started out.
Well, I'm sure it must have been a takeoff of some horror movie, it's like the whole thing, like it's a, children's product, and trying to, you have the evil clown that's going to give them nightmares instead of make them smile. And he was really, really good in this role as this maniacal character that could flip from being sort of happy to sad to angry you know, in a matter of like a blink of an eye.
Yeah, it may. I don't know this for sure, but it may have been a takeoff of Ed Gein. I mean, I don't.
Wait, was Ed Gein?
I mean, it's a Bruce.
Or just thinking of what's his face. Why am I forgetting his name all of a sudden? Gacy.
John Wayne Gacy. That's right, not Gacy. John Wayne Gacy. I mean, it was a Bruce Prichard idea, but Bruce Prichard's the one that created this. So, and then of course when Matt Bourne came back, when he resurfaced in ECW the next year, he did a really interesting deal where he was playing Bourne again, where he was playing, his gimmick was he was half Doink, half Matt Bourne.
But that he had gone crazy from playing Doink.
He had gone crazy from playing Doink. And again, he had issues that killed that run. But
he was gone after 3 months, right? Less.
Yeah, that could have been a big deal in ECW in that time period if he would have stayed the course. Because this was in 94 going into 95, right when ECW is starting to find their way. And yeah, I mean, it was just a really deep gimmick that was totally for the internet and stuff like that, and for the smart newsletter fans, but I thought he was awesome in that role.
And it was the perfect gimmick for that era of ECW. Like, if he sticks around longer, that becomes like an ECW-defining gimmick.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder, I mean, this is pre-Raven. If Matt Bourne stays the course in that gimmick, like, do we get the Raven gimmick?
I don't know.
It's an interesting what if.
Well, I think Johnny Polo would have come in. Scott Levy would have come in anyway.
Of course. Just
whether he would have done that gimmick.
Well, he might have done that gimmick, but it might not have been as big.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you're pushing Bourne in that role as the lead heel, then yeah, who knows? As I said, so it's an interesting what if.
Wasn't the reason that Raven didn't go to Smoky Mountain was that Cornette wanted him to be some variation of Scotty the Body, and he wanted to change?
Yes. Yeah. That's what I believe, yeah. So, and that made his career. So, he made the right decision. But anyway, back to WWF, and we have more disciplinary issues. Same day! What a day for WWF, September 15th. Rick and Scott Steiner are suspended and have been pulled from 8 weeks' worth of bookings from September 24th to November 24th. But they are already being advertised for the November 27th Madison Square Garden show against the Quebecers. Because of the shortage of top babyface tag teams, Bam Bam Bigelow and Adam Bomb, well, Bam Bam was a babyface picks, will remain in the challenger slot on upcoming tag team title match at house shows, with Quebecers replacing Steiners as champions in the match. Well, I guess not. So basically, they were doing heel versus heels. It is not necessarily a given that the Steiners will return as planned after the 8-week suspension. The Steiners were not especially happy with their situation in WWF before their suspension, including pay, which didn't come close to their reported $6,000 per week each in WCW. However, if the Steiners signed a 2-year standard deal with WWF last December, they would be ineligible to wrestle in the U.S. until December 1994. It's possible they could wrestle part-time for New Japan Pro Wrestling. The WWF obviously believes the Steiners will return after the 8-week suspension, since their first date back could be Survivor Series on the 24th. It is unknown what the contractual situation is with the brothers, but it is believed they inked a Titan deal on around December 16, 1992. Generally, these initial deals run for 2 years, although there have been those who have said the Steiners only signed a 1-year deal. Either way, they wouldn't be legally out of the work for anyone without Titan release until December 1994, at the earliest it's coming December. Titan could conceivably not block their path if they came to a deal with New Japan, but they almost surely would enforce the contract if it came to any attempts to negotiate with WCW. New Japan would only book the Steiners for a certain number of weeks per year, likely 10 or less, and WWF does have a certain lure to it about being the big time in the United States, even though the per-week money would be expected to be much higher with New Japan than WWF. The WWF booking them on a year-round schedule would add up to more money. Now, Keith, they had just lost the titles on the 13th to the Quebecers in a match where they lost it by DQ. So it wasn't even a clean loss. And there was like fear that if they asked, Scott Steiner to do a clean job, that there may have been problems. So they came up with a DQ finish and change the titles that way, and then they were suspended after that.
Province of Quebec rules.
Province of yes. Quebec rules. But
now, do you guys remember what the reason why they what the idea behind, or at least the Vince idea behind doing that was? Besides the having a way to do the DQ.
I don't remember now.
They were making fun of WCW and NWA member promotions and Southern promotions and all the different rules they had that the WWF didn't have.
Ah, okay.
So because it was pile drivers DQ, jumping off the top rope is a DQ, throwing someone over the top rope is a DQ, titles can change hands on DQs, titles can change hands on count and outs. So they threw in the WCW like and Memphis parody stuff with titles can change hands or DQ or count out.
That's interesting. But yeah, Keith, the Steiners, you know, they've been in WF for, you know, all 1993 so far. They, like we talked about on previous shows with the Steiners, they were kind of like the Road Warriors in a way. Once they went WF, they became like sterilized and weren't the same guys that was in WCW.
Yeah, that's, I think the Steiners were probably fit slightly better than the Road Warriors because, you know, they tinkered with the Road Warriors more. So, you know, they turned them into the Legion of Doom.
You're right.
And also later on, obviously, you had, you know, they didn't bring them in with Paul Ellering. And when Ellering came in, you had Rocco the Puppet. So I just think, though, that, you know, the tag division was quite uninteresting at the time. There's a lot of good teams, but there was no real feuds.
Yeah, guys, so, the Beverly Brothers, the Quebecers,
Money Inc. just left.
Money Inc. then dissolved.
Heavenly Bodies part time.
Heavenly Bodies had just come in.
Yeah.
In fact, they were doing a deal with the Steiners. In fact, which we'll talk about later in the show in Smoky Mountain. With Head Shrinkers was there, right?
Yes.
Head Shrinkers were there. I mean, so there were tag teams, but it wasn't. It wasn't like it was a WCW the year before when you had all kinds of, you know, great tag matches going on.
Well, you know what it is, really? I think it was less booking and more just they didn't really have guys who could work well with the Steiners or what people expected out of the Steiners at that time. I mean, you think back especially, I mean, it was an issue with the name guys too, but you have to remember with the job guys, like they had trouble finding job guys that they thought could safely take their moves. That they started using Mike Enos under a mask, including one of my favorite weird stories where they started using him under a mask as in squash matches, including under a mask as Dan Farron.
Which, well, and Dan Farron's a name from the last show who was a promoter in Southern California.
Our friend Dan Farron, yes.
That's right. But yeah, I mean, it was a different style than what they had been working in WCW, and they got over, but it just wasn't the same. It just wasn't a good fit.
If they had the Quebecers sooner or the Heavenly Bodies, or if they had been worked with the Head Shrinkers a little more, or they had, like, you know, Bigelow and a partner or something, I think it would have worked better.
And you know what? They're, I mean,
well, it's because they booked them against Money Inc. the whole time.
And if you remember, their most famous match in WWF is a match between Brett and Owen Hart. You know, of all people. You know,
well, it's become their most famous match. Like, it's their best. It's the best one, and it's kind of become the most famous because, you know, legend wise. But because that really, but if you think of like their most famous of the TV matches and stuff, I mean, there's nothing that really stands out too much. But it would probably be like the Heavenly Bodies match by default, or the Money Inc. match that aired the week before by default.
Yeah.
I really liked the SummerSlam match. I thought that, even though it's short, it was a really fun sprint. So that would probably what I would choose.
And then, you know, they came back. So they eventually did come back, you know.
They did come back before Survivor Series because they shot the angle with, was it Rick or Scott who they injured?
Well,
oh, no, it was Tatanka who they injured, not Rick and Scott. But Rick and Scott did work tapings before Survivor Series, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if that works, Survivor Series, of course.
Right.
So, yeah, so they did come back, although they didn't stay real long, though, when they came back, because they were gone. Wow.
No, they actually stayed through... No, because they were doing New Japan tours in between. That's why it seems like they left sooner than they actually did, because I think the last taping they worked had one of them in a King of the Ring qualifier. So they were around to like eight. They were around on TV till like May or June, and probably actually there till like April.
They were there in April.
Yeah, but I mean, they weren't on WrestleMania or anywhere near WrestleMania.
Yeah, their last appearance.
Actually, wait, or were they in the 10-man tag that got moved? They weren't, right?
I'm looking right now.
I don't think they were.
No, they weren't in Mania, because they went to Europe in February, and they came back in April, and they're only back for like 10 days.
Hmm.
Their last appearance is on the May 7th, 94 episode of Superstars, where IRS pinned Scott Steiner in a King of the Ring qualifying match. Then IRS avoided them, the brothers, by running through the crowd, and that was their last appearance. So, yeah, I mean, and then, of course, you know, they didn't wrestle again in the U.S.
Well, they had didn't they do a couple Peach State matches?
Yes, they did, and they did them in '95 too. So,
right, and they also there was the deal with Super Bowl with Smoky Mountain, where there was the confusion over the price and who was getting booked, and but that was right when they start with ECW anyway, and there was the near miss with WCW that we've talked about too, and is that about it? I think that's it.
Yeah. So yeah, again, they never were the same after they left for WCW, and the reason why they left WCW is because Bill Watts wanted to turn them heel. That and contract status.
Break them up, yeah.
But he wanted to split them up, turn Scott heel, and Scott got pissed off, which eventually, you know, they eventually did, and Scott became a big, you know, big star from it, which is hilarious. But either way,
so one thing I just wanted to mention was that there's lots of multiple stories about why the Steiners dropped the belts to the Quebecers in the way they did, because 1 week before in the Torch, they said, like, the assumption was the Steiners wouldn't want to do the job. You know, the Torch was saying that I think it was because Raw, you know, maybe they'd just been preempted because of the US Open or something like that.
That's right.
That they wanted to boost ratings. And so, you know, their idea to do that was to do the title switch. You know, so, and it's also interesting because the Observer, after the suspension came up, alluded to the fact that maybe they had to take the belts off the Steiners because one of them might have failed a drug test.
Gee, so I wonder if that would have
been. Three different stories. Well, it's...
Moves one or the other.
Yeah.
And the deal about the ratings is funny because the rating that they did was they did a 1.2. So it didn't work. that was below what they had been doing.
Was the catalyst for Raw really going back up like in 94 and 95 then?
I really don't know how to go back. We have to go back and probably look at that and see.
Because they started hitting threes in 94. I mean, maybe it was around WrestleMania?
It could have been Brett being the champion again. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or Brett the Bretto and Feud would have been a draw. So, and that could have been why. But, yeah, it was just, again, a fit that just, it didn't work out for anyone involved. But we got a departure. Not suspension related, but contract related. As Mean Gene Okerlund makes his last appearance on WWF television until 2001 on the September 18th episode of Superstars, doing the face-to-face promo segments. Me and Gene had been there for 9 years and was, I think, easily the most popular non-wrestler in the company. A guy that I know, our buddy Charles, I think, has made this statement that Gene Okerlund should be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, Gene Okerlund probably sold as many tickets to WWF shows as most of the wrestlers. Keith, I mean, he was a big reason for the success in a lot of ways. I mean, he did a house in Minnesota. You know, Minneapolis would tag him with Hogan, his first match against George Steele and Mr. Fuji. They sold the place out.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he was as big as anybody in that time.
Well, he had great chemistry with all the wrestlers, I think. You know, he just, you know, he could banter back and forth with them. You know, and not in a way which sort of got in their way, if that makes sense. So he worked very well in that role, and he was iconic for his time. I don't know. It just seemed though that, you know, he didn't fit in quite as well as he used to do. I don't know whether that was because he felt to be synonymous with Hulk Hogan and Hogan leaving, but he just doesn't seem, I don't know, he doesn't seem to fit in quite as well towards the end of his run in the WWF, whereas he you know, actually probably fit in better in WCW when he eventually, you know, started working there, because he was with Hogan again, he was with Flair, who he had, like, bags of chemistry with.
And one thing is, when Gene went to WCW, he was able to be more of a character in WCW, yeah, than where he was in WWF. Early on, he was a character in WWF in a lot of ways. But yeah, as the run went on, you know, he became basically like some of the wrestlers did in the WWF, where, you know, they've been there a long time, and sometimes it was time to move on, and he did. And, you know, of course, Heenan would follow up a few months later. But Oakland, they replaced him with
Joe Fowler.
Joe Fowler.
He ended up doing infomercials again, but was then known as an infomercial guy. I believe, what was he doing, Microcrisp?
Yeah. And Sean Mooney at this time period
was about to leave.
was working for ESPN2.
Oh, he did leave already. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, he left right after Raw started.
Yeah, he was on ESPN2 doing this is the early days of ESPN2, where they did like a 4-hour block of selling sports collectibles. And he was kind of like the Don West of that show. Can you imagine Sean Mooney as Don West?
Oh, but you're going to freak Parv out with this now.
But yeah, he was on there shilling autographed baseballs, baseball cards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where he was gone to. So yeah, I mean, they brought that Joe Fowler guy in. I don't know how long he lasted.
Well, and they had already kind of... Now, wait, when they brought in Bonnie Blackstone, now, had she left yet?
No, Bonnie was there. She was on television.
Yeah, Bonnie was there still.
But was she only doing Challenge, or and he was doing Superstars, or how did that work?
She was doing Challenge, because Gene was on Superstars.
Okay. What happened with that? Like, why did she come and go so quickly? Because she was really good there.
I think it was more a Joe thing.
That Joe didn't want her on WWF
think that she just wanted to be back home.
Oh. Even if it was just once, even if it was just
because
one weekend
she,
when a month?
She left, see, when they started up another block not too long after this in Atlanta on a low reception channel, Channel 14, where they restarted the wrestling block back up. Her and Joe did it. So yeah, I think that's what it was. She just wanted to restart her wrestling block back up.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it was sign of the times where WWF is trying to go to a new, younger group of talent.
I'm surprised they didn't try harder to keep her though with Gene leaving.
Yeah.
And she wasn't Renee Young, but she was.
Well, we know their track record.
She was better than just about everyone else they hired around that
time. We know their track record with women. Vince may have tried to get something in a limo. So, yeah, who knows? But anyway.
Whatever happened to that David Vixen's fan fella that, you know,
Jesus.
That was an announcer for the WWF for a while?
You know what happened. I see. I
Sorry.
Oh, me.
See, now now there are people who aren't going to get that now that I changed my my Twitter icon from Murray to Purple Haze.
Yeah, Keith with his Twitter inside humor on this show. On the Monday Night Raw, they aired on September 20th. PJ Walker scores a huge upset victory over Irwin R. Shyster after distraction by Razor Ramon. PJ Walker, of course, would grow up to become Aldo Montoya, and he grew up to become Justin Credible. So this is kind of like trying to recapture Lightning in a Bottle, no pun intended, with the 1-2-3 Kid.
Oh, come on. You intended the hell out of that pun.
But they never went anywhere with it, with PJ Walker. So, but yeah, it's a funny little little note there.
I don't know whether that was the point, was to make PJ Walker into another 1-2-3 Kid.
Oh, of course not.
I think the idea was playing off the 1-2-3 Kid in the sense that, obviously how the storyline started was Razor Ramon was embarrassed by this upstart, and IRS, Ramon was in a feud with IRS at the time. He had beaten 1-2-3 Kid at SummerSlam. So this was Razor embarrassing him in a similar fashion, which I think Ted DiBiase and IRS had made fun of Razor Ramon of. So it's sort of, finishing that story off, I think, more than trying to make another 1-2-3 Kid, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you're right. But they just never followed up on it, though.
Yeah.
And Walker Bix, like I said, we're going to become Aldo Montoya, and boy, was that a flop. But he did pretty well, though. It's just incredible.
He did. He was overpushed, though. I mean, which ended up making him a really underrated performer, too.
Yeah.
That he got so overpushed that people kind of just thought of him as being not that good. But no, he was really good. He just wasn't the guy. But he was really, I think people eventually, when he sort of got moved down as to more of a tag team guy in ECW, and then when he started doing post-ECW indie stuff like ROH, I think people started to more catch on that he was good. But it wasn't even the character was bad. It was just they shoved him down your throat. It's not that I don't get what Paul Heyman didn't see in him. I just don't get why he saw so much in him.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't have much left at the end to choose from as well.
But he started pushing him from the second he got him, heavily.
Yeah, he put him over Sasuke.
He did, but it was still in the mid-card.
That was a guy. But
he had Jason and Nicole Bass and Chastity. Yeah. He wasn't up there yet, but it wasn't long, though, that they started pushing him higher. And in 99, it became the Just Incredible show.
And the Sasuke thing, too, was just something. They hadn't done that before with any of their outsiders, with any of the international guys. So to do that was still pretty big for the time.
Yeah. And now we're going to go to my favorite WWF news bit of the section here. Sports Manager Group from Dallas, Texas, did a poll over the last 2 months of 1992, which the results were printed in newspapers nationwide over the weekend, saying that WWF Pro Wrestling, that's right, quote-unquote WWF Pro Wrestling, was the most disliked sport in the country among a sample size of 1,479 people aged 12 and older, balanced and weighted, providing a sample of the entire U.S. population. Now, WWF has always placed high on this list, including finishing first in 1991. Vince McMahon would send a letter to SMG demanding they not include WWF in such polls in the future, saying, quote, We do not wish to be included in your survey because WWF is not a sport. It is a unique brand of sports entertainment. But I'll reiterate, WWF wrestling is not a sport.
Who was it that they pulled this with a couple years ago? Hollywood Reporter?
Yes.
The Hall of Fame thing, right? Where it was Drew Carey, I think?
Yes.
Where they got like this angry email from whoever, was in WWE PR at the time, saying like, hey, this is not wrestling, because the headline was something like Drew Carey inducted into to be inducted into Wrestling Hall of Fame or something like that. And WWE was really angry, like, oh, it's not wrestling anymore. Could you please take this down? And then followed up, like, they were like kind of demanding too, and or to change it, not to take it down. And then the guy who wrote it was like, called it like, but okay, what are the matches? But don't they have wrestling matches, right? No, and whoever was, she said, no, they're not called wrestling matches anymore. They do entertainments. And eventually said, like, look, I'm not just going to change this because you demanded it. I'll either leave it as it is or take it down. And she said, if you're going to do one or the other, take it down. Which is something that they would never do today, even, what, how many years later is it? Five? Yeah. Six?
But the thing is, Keith, and this is a great thing for you to talk about, is that, you know, in the United States, they were down in a big way. But this time period in Europe, which I was talking about in the last show, I mean, they are peaking.
Yeah, they really were, because they'd got on Sky Sports, so the satellite channel, and there was becoming a big boom in selling satellite dishes. So lots of people, you know, lots of children who were lucky enough to get satellite TV became big fans at the time. Like I got a satellite dish. Our family did in 1995, so Christmas of 94, 95, and that's when I became a big fan of the WWF. So, you know, a bit behind everyone else, though. You know, as 92, you know, was SummerSlam.
And what's funny is this quote unquote WWF wrestling. We'll come up again later in the show in regards to WCW in a funny way. So it's funny how any wrestling is labeled as WWF at a time, which it would be like that for years to come. It's kind of like how all you hear some people say, you know, when they were talking about even like non-UFC organizations and MMA or match, they call it UFC. It's like you're branded, anything is branded as UFC.
That still happens a lot. WWE, I feel like, happens less. And I feel like that's almost more because of, even though they're more synonymous with it now, which is weird, I feel like almost like, I'm trying to think why. Like, why do you think that is? Like, is it because people are culturally aware of, like, Lucha Libre? Like, I'm trying to think, like, what it could be. Like, that people have an idea of other things existing?
Yeah, I think more often than not, that's what it is. You know, right.
They have a vague idea of, oh, there are Mexican wrestlers in masks that are not WWF. I mean that as an example.
Or, you know, other wrestling promotions here or in Japan or whatever. I mean, there's more awareness now than ever.
I mean, on the average person, though. But, I mean, and even, like, if you hear someone in the mainstream make that comparison, they say it in a more natural way. Like, they say WWE wrestling or WWF wrestling. They don't just, you know what I mean? They say it in a way where they're kind of, it sounds like they're saying it's a brand.
Exactly. All right. Now let's talk about New Japan. We're going to the land of the rising sun. And they have a big show on September 20th, which is the start of a big tour. One of the biggest money-making tours of New Japan of the early part of the 90s. But they have so much going on. Hogan's there working the shows. Royal Hawk's there. There's some big names coming in. But on this show in particular, at the Aichi Prefectural Gym in Nagoya, in front of a legit turnaway crowd of 11,500, which based on ticket prices would have been a gate of near $700,000 U.S., Shinya Hashimoto defeated the Great Muta in 2030 with a jumping DDT to win the IWGP Heavyweight title. After the match, Hashimoto issued challenges to Tenryu, who has pinned in twice in singles matches this year, Tatsumi Fujinami, and Riki Choshu for title matches. And he said he wants his first title defense to be against Tenryu. Muta pretty much had to lose the title, as doing two non-title jobs for Hulk Hogan and never getting to beat him would hurt the belt's credibility as a world title. In addition, New Japan attempts to keep a form of parity with all of its top stars. Any one of the top guys can be any other top guys. And since Hashimoto did two jobs for Tenryu and was eliminated by Hiroshi Hase in the first round of the G1 tournament, he needed a big win to maintain his position. Now, Biggs, this is like a kind of the rebirth of Hashimoto in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I actually
he had been de-pushed.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember in the context of what was going on at the time. I don't think I've seen as much of 93 as I have of the other years. I'm trying to remember the context of this.
Well, it's more like 93 was the Muda show in a lot of ways, the Muto show. Of course, you know, Chono's around. And
you had right now I'm remembering, like, Fujinami was rebounding a little bit. And was because I'm thinking, when I think of 93, I think mostly about Outsiders and to an extent Muda.
Yeah, so 93 is heavy. The war feud is heavy in New Japan by this time. And Tenryu is revitalized. That, you know, I mean, well, I was gonna say revitalized, but added a new dynamic to the promotion coming in and out.
Yeah, but Hashimoto, I feel like, doesn't really become the guy till about 94, like really cement his position.
And that's what I'm saying. This is like the rebirth. This is the beginning of that.
That Hashimoto.
He becomes the ace of the promotion, and then he became, you know, one of the best guys in the world. But yeah, Keith, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to get the title off Muda, like Dave was saying, because Muda's about to do jobs for Hogan. So you don't want your champion to come out, you know, even though it's Hulk Hogan, you don't want him doing two jobs in a row. So smart move in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I think I don't like the word parity booking, because maybe because it's been sort of bastardized today with WWE, where it seems like one guy wins and then, you know, they do a feud, one guy wins, then the guy he's feuding with wins the next match, and then, you know, so it's 50-50. Whereas this is I think more people go on runs. And so I think it's better than parity. It's more sophisticated than just even Steven booking. I think because clearly Hashimoto was the guy who was chosen to get the big win against Tenryu at the end of the war feud, because, you know, after Hashimoto beat Tenryu in, I think it was about February 94, Tenryu doesn't stop making as many New Japan appearances.
Yeah, and it's I agree with the parity booking deal, because what it's doing is if you're booking long term, which I don't know how long term they were booking with Hashimoto, you know, losing those matches to Tenryu, and then him win the title, the natural challenge is Tenryu because he has those wins over him. So it's not like WWE where, you know, Cesaro beats Kevin Owens on Raw on Monday, then loses to Kevin Owens on SmackDown on Thursday to make up. So you have that happen twice, you know, have it happen a few days behind each other. This is a build of a story. And one thing you got to give Gato and Jado credit in doing over the last few years in New Japan is they've been very thoughtful of this process where, you know, you beat the champion and said the G1, you're going to get a title shot not too long after the fact.
But for a few years, they did get kind of trapped in the G1 of booking the too many guys to be alive on the last day of the league.
Well, of course. That's a total different deal. I'm talking about the champion.
Yeah. No. They've been protecting the champions tremendously well.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the tournament. I'm talking about the champion setting a future shot to the title. Yeah, that's a whole other argument there, which I agree with. But, you're making the champion losing non-title matches important because it sets up down the road. So, yeah, it was a very smart move. And Choshu, of course, at this time was, you know, a booking mastermind. And speaking of Choshu, he is off the road right now because he is mending his torn Achilles heel. So Hiroshi Hase, his top assistant, is handling the day-to-day booking. And, of course, Hase was the guy that was mainly booking the juniors at this time period with Liger, and, of course, assisting Choshu with the heavyweights. But Hase's a guy, and we talk about this as well, Bix, that doesn't get nearly enough credit for his booking mind.
What were you saying last time? You were telling me that he booked the juniors before Liger did?
I think him and Liger started doing it together.
Yeah, I mean, he... Well, like, wasn't part of it, too, that he also was the guy that kind of smoothed things over with the wrestlers that didn't like Choshu?
That was part of it. And, of course, he's a Choshu disciple from the start, anyway.
Right, so. But he's all, and he was also the guy that could go out there, and he was the professional. He was the guy, he's like, hey, I'm in the office, I'm one of the bookers, but I'm going to go out there, I'm going to make everyone look great, I'm going to do jobs, etc. So he was also he was like the example, like, you know, one of the bookers is going to do this, then you know, there's no reason not for you not to.
And kind of like Gato today in a lot of ways. You know, where Gato will go out and do jobs and stuff like that. Although he said in an advanced stage of his career, Hase was in his prime at this stage of his career. But I mean, total selflessness and a guy who Keith, I've talked to people that's worked with Hase over the years and stuff like that, and nobody has a bad word to say about him. He is a super nice guy. Everybody really likes him. You know, he was kind of the good cop bad cop to Choshu.
He was a really great worker, super smooth, you know, could make anyone look good. So I'm not surprised. I'm sure, you know, as they say in wrestling, I'm sure he would be a night off to work with. You know, in the sense that he'd be easy to work with, no problems, could make you look good. So I'm not surprised that everyone speaks so highly of him.
And one thing you look at is after he leaves in 97, if I'm not mistaken, around this time period in 97, the booking changes. He pretty much becomes all Choshu. And New Japan, I mean, they have some good stuff going on, but it's not the same as it was.
It's when the cracks started to show.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, the original retirement match was January 4th, 96, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was already on his way out because of the politics a few months earlier. And look at how Choshu handled the initial UWFI feud, which if Hase is more involved at that point, I don't know if that happens quite the way it did.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, it becomes the Choshu show, and Choshu starts pushing a lot of his guys up higher than maybe he should have. And yeah, it become, you know, very political. While Hase, of course, with All Japan, and you know, he had some really strong matches in All Japan too. He wasn't part of the office at that time period. He was just working a wrestler. So, yeah, kind of a career renaissance for him.
We probably should mention why Hase left for All Japan.
Yes, I think we should.
Yeah, go ahead.
Should I?
Well, okay. I'll let Vix do it because he'll probably have the story better than me.
Okay. I'm forgetting his name all of a sudden. Gompei. Right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
What was the first name? Hirometsu, I think?
Yeah.
The training.
So Hirometsu Gompei was his high-level college wrestler, I believe. And they had been recruiting him for a while into the dojo. And his parents were really, really reluctant. And finally, it was Hase reassuring them, because I guess he was the guy they saw as trustworthy. When did he get elected to office originally? Was he in office by that point?
Yeah.
Okay. So here they have this guy who's basically a senator or congress. I forget how the two different houses in Japan work. Basically a congressman, you know, saying that he will personally look out for their son, if, you know, whatever, or et cetera. And that convinced them. And he goes to the dojo. And so the story that was in Ring of Hell, which is the most complete one that's out there, was that, think now, and I'm trying to remember because my memory is that he didn't say who told it, but it sounded like Scott Norton. Does that sound right? Because whoever he quoted, I mean, the speech patterns did. Does that sound right?
I
might be thinking of something else. I don't want to say that it was Norton if it wasn't him.
But I don't think, I'm not sure it was a story.
It was clearly an American, though. It wasn't Nishimura. because he quoted Nishimura a bit, but this was someone who was a native English speaker, and that it was something like he'd been doing exercises all day, and then later that day, I think it was Choshu came by to check out his progress and the progress of the other dojo boys, and he was so tired because they had done like their usual workload of training in you know, in ring and out, and remember, this is a place called Hell Camp, unofficially, that he was blowing spots when he was working out with Kensuke Sasaki. And Sasaki got mad, suplexed him a few times, he hit his head bad, and I believe died of a brain bleed or something similar.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds about right.
And, you know, this was one of those things that's always been shrouded in secrecy, but... So, I mean, whoever it was is one that told the story to Matt Randazzo, it was, you know, it's clearly one of the Americans that was around back then. And, I mean, we know... The story had always been Kensuke Sasaki just beat the guy up bad enough that he got a head injury and died. So, that's the most specific version we've heard.
Yeah.
And, Hasei felt terribly guilty, felt responsible, and quit the company.
And there were also money reasons, too.
Yeah. But
there were money reasons, too.
There are always money reasons.
So that's another thing, too. But anyway, moving on to FMW, as we have no All Japan this week because they were on hiatus. Mitsuhiro Matsunaga makes his debut in the promotion. When the tour starts on September 15th in Tokorozawa, teaming with a longtime rival, Mr. Pogo from Ween, and they defeat Atsushi Onita, Mr. Ganosuke, in a no-rope barbed wire match. This is a big deal. We talked about Masanaga on this show before, Mr. Danger. This is now, we're starting to get in that era where he's becoming a big name. And this is, you know, four of the top deathmatch workers here now feuding in FMW. And FMW is starting to get big. Onita's talking about wanting to run the Tokyo Dome in 94, which of course never happened. And FMW is starting to hit their peak. I mean, they're doing they're going to do a 5,000 seat venue in Tokyo later in the year as like a test run for the Dome. So, I mean, yeah, FMW was the main show in town. And it, you know, made sense for Matsunaga to jump there, and Mr. Pogo's there. So, this is when FMW's really starting to make their name. And, Keith, we've talked about Matsunaga, you know, and all these wild, crazy death matches that he did. Were you ever a big fan of that style, or did you just not get into it?
I'm not a huge fan of it, but I think when I see like more recently some of the Big Japan matches on say one of Will's match of the year contenders sort of DVD sets, I usually enjoy them. I mean, it's not something I sought out when I was younger, but obviously, this was a really big deal, because, like, well, I think as we see, throughout, Japanese history in this time, that the interpromotional angle was usually a winner until every group had probably worked with each other too many times, more recently.
Yeah, I'll say. Yeah, they ran that into the ground then, now, and forever in Japan. But moving on to a totally different style, we go to JWP. And on September 18th at Saitama, there's a special show celebrating the 16th anniversary of Devil Masami titled Devil Super Heel Night, where Devil Masami had a match with Plum Mariko where she would work a super heel style, quote unquote, and Dave said she did. So
this like her Great Muda type persona?
Yeah. Now, could you imagine today, like WWE promoting a Bray Wyatt heel night or something like that? You know, just saying the word heel, openly. It's pretty odd, Keith.
But it's not insider term exactly.
Yeah, but 1993 Japan. You know, I mean, what do you think, Keith?
Well, I think Sasha Super Heel Night might be really awesome. But I can't see WWE ever doing that because, well, you know, maybe in NXT, but I'll be surprised if Triple H has watched any Devil Miss Army Super Heel work.
I doubt it too. Vix, real quick, talk about Plum Mariko.
GWP, so I honestly can't say that much about her. I really know. I mean, I know that she was considered a great worker, and you know, I know plenty about her death and stuff. But
that's what I was talking about.
Yeah, oh, okay, death. Yeah. I never really got to see much GWP. Because she died like taking like a Liger bomb wrong, and didn't one of the women wrestlers who either got a bad brain injury or died not long after her also died taking the same bump? Like, didn't Emiko Kato die taking the same bump?
I can't remember.
I remember something like that.
I know, Mayumi Ozaki's the one that gave it to her. And after the finish, it wasn't the planned finish, supposedly.
No, she was out in her... No, her, I think she went out snoring. Right away, and her brain was... Yeah, her brain was bleeding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was out snoring. And it died a few hours later. And supposedly she already had head injuries going in.
Right, she had a bunch of concussions going in. I've always found it interesting that... I mean, it hasn't happened now for years, but... Some of them fatal, some of those was not. It feels like we've had a lot more of those in Japan than we have... here, like really bad brain injuries.
Exactly.
And like more acute bad brain injuries.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a difference in, you know, the styles and all that other stuff, so.
Yeah.
But, and another thing about Plum Mariko, she's the one that invented the stretch plump. It's named after her. So,
okay. I don't think I realized that, because I always associated it with Kawada.
You always said Kawada? Yeah. but she's the one that innovated it. So,
and did they call it stretch plum in all Japan?
Yeah, they did. Okay. Well, yeah, so that's an interesting little side note. We have a promotion debuting now this week. As we talked about them on the previous show and with our good buddy Sean Wheelock, Pancrase has their first show on September 21st before a sellout crowd of 7,000 at the Tokyo Bay NK Hall with a very unique show. Now, this is I'm quoting our good friend Dave Meltzer here. It sounds very markish to say that Pancrase Wrestling is real shooting, because groups that claim to be that all seem to be something less. But the reason Minoru Suzuki and Masakatsu Funaki formed a new group and quit Pro Wrestling Fujiwara Gumi, at least publicly, was because they didn't want to have pre-planned winners. Anyway, the card itself was described to be an amazing show, even though the five matches only lasted a total of 13 minutes of wrestling time, which made it surprising and different from any other style in Japan. I'm not sure what else they did, and some fans couldn't have been happy paying $135 ringside for 13 minutes of wrestling. The main event saw Ken Wayne Shamrock defeat Masakatsu Funaki with a sleeper hold in 6 minutes and 15 seconds. Now, also on the show, we had the debuts of Mari Smith and Boss Rutten on the show. So, pretty newsworthy show, Bix, and this was Pancrase got to be a big deal. After this.
Yeah. I guess the people saw the short matches as being shoots, and I mean, they were, but it also led to the best guys and the guys in the office deciding to carry guys, because they were worried about a backlash over the short fights. So, yeah, it got pretty big, and it was, I mean, but I guess some people call it the first MMA promotion over, you know, because they started a couple months before UFC. I think, Chris, you'd probably agree with me that Chudo should really be called the first, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because that goes back to, what is it, 89 for amateur shows and 90 for pro?
Yeah, Sayama started it around 89, yeah.
But it's weird. Now, the thing I always wondered, I mean, they had, I know Chudo didn't have stars other than just Sayama was the promoter and the face of it. But why did it get zero attention? Why didn't really have, like, a revival after Pancrase got big? I never understood that. Like, yeah, Pancrase had the stars, and they had this, these established guys who had gotten big in the second UWF, and some of whom it's been in New Japan in a little while, but why was there nothing? Like, why was Shudo so under the radar that people didn't know it existed? Like, when you start getting non-UFC, you know, American MMA, Eric Paulson was on, which one was it, World Combat Championship, I think?
Sounds right.
And he talks about being a Japanese, you know, lightweight or whatever clay class they said it was, shoot fighting champion. And he's like, that's clearly not true because Pancrase is the only promotion that promotes itself as shoot fighting or whatever it was, or shoot wrestling. And then he ended up correcting it. And I always found that weird. Like, do you have any idea why?
We talk about, you know, Shudo eventually got a name later on, you know, when Minoru Suzuki went there. He became the top guy.
When was that?
Uno.
When was Minoru Suzuki there?
Well, he was in Shudo. If I'm not mistaken, Minoru Suzuki was Shudo.
Are you sure?
I know. Car Uno was the.
Well, yeah. Uno, and of course, you know. Then, well, no, I mean they built stars eventually. They, you know, Uno, and why am I forgetting his name all of a sudden? Sato. What's his name? The guy who, what's his name? Joe Silva named his cat after. Rumina Sato.
Rumina Sato. That's right. Yeah, I thought Minoru, I mean, I could be wrong. I seem to remember Minoru.
Unless he worked in Shudo, like, much later.
This would have been in the 2000s.
Okay, yeah, when Shudo was more of just a mainstream, one of many smaller MMA promotions. They still have some kind of unique rule set because they have, you know, the different things and the different amateur rules and stuff, but they didn't really have any, but they didn't have like stars to build on. I guess that's why, but I don't know. That just always seemed weird to me that it was such an under the radar thing that there's so little known about it. I mean, you look online, you're not really going to find much other than like those, the title histories and stuff and the stuff like the results, but no one really saying, explaining anything about it, about those early Shudo cards from like 90 to 93 or 94.
Yeah, I guess it's just the style wasn't as big because you had the shoot style wrestling promotions that were putting on bigger shows. You know, and putting on the work shoot matches.
Right, even after Pancrase, you would think that.
Well, then Pride started up at the Pancrase. Got, you know, Pride was 97.
But that was several years later, though.
I mean, well, Pancrase was going in after that.
But I'm saying, wasn't Shudo able to pick it up?
Nobody went there. No, there were no big names.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So we're agreeing that that's probably why. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it looks like Suzuki's whole MMA career was in Pancrase.
Okay. Okay. But, yeah, I mean,
He had the fight with Solar in Deep, but Deep was kind of a Pancrase spinoff. At least back then it was.
Yeah. But Keith, you know, this, like I said, you know, this is a big show. Ken Shamrock going over for Naki, you know, in a legit match. You know, like I said, the debuts of Murray Smith and Boss Rutten on this show become huge names in Japan and, of course, America. This is the beginning of a new revolution in Japan.
Well, I watched the Shamrock versus Funaki match last night, and you know, I think watching the match, you wouldn't say that any of the fans seemed unhappy about, you know, paying so much money for, you know, a really short main event. You know, the fans were really into it because obviously they could sense that this was something different, that this was, you know, sort of, I don't know if I'd go so far, you know, so far as a shoot, but it seemed more like a shoot than anything they've seen before.
Well, it was, because they were no predetermined winners.
Well, and you could tell that from the match, because, you know, they're, you know, basically, you know, sort of Shamrock controlled the position, so you know they had a stalemate on the mat with two leg locks. Then Shamrock, you know, tried for a takedown, sort of ended up on top of Funaki, and then you know sort of rode him, and eventually got a, as it was said there, a sleeper hold of some sort. So it wasn't a back and forth match that you would expect. Yeah, it was very one sided, a clear cut win for Shamrock.
Yeah, and made him he was already a star in Japan, but that really put him over the top after that. And we talked about UWFI. UWFI has an interesting thing going on this week, and it's not in Japan, as they had two matches in Nashville, Tennessee, as part of a boxing card on September 18th. Now, it's the second or third time the UWFI has had matches on local boxing programs. And based on the reports that were sent to The Observer, the boxing fans love UWFI and all believe it to be real pro wrestling because they work so stiff and believably. The bouts this time saw Masahito Kakihara knock out Ray Lloyd, which was, I think, Glacier, and Billy Scott over Yoji Anjo. So Yoji Anjo is doing a job on the Nashville, Tennessee. A newspaper report on the first time UWFI had a match in the boxing show said that it stole the show, and this time the fans who had seen the initial match were anticipating the wrestling matches more than the boxing matches. Now, Bix, I'm thinking here, and we're in Nashville, Tennessee.
Now, by the way, did these ever show up on tape on any of the UWFI tapes?
I remember seeing it on tape lists.
Okay.
So I remember seeing it around. I haven't seen it. But September 18th, I mean, we're in Nashville, Tennessee. UWFI guys are there. Can you just imagine if Yoji Anjo worked the Mid-South Coliseum? put him up against Jerry Lawler.
Now, what day of the week was this?
That would have been on Saturday.
So wrestling would have been at the fairgrounds that night?
Yes, it was. In fact, Lawler and Tatanka were the main event at the fairgrounds.
Okay, that's interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, think about it. If Anjo and Kakihara going over and like doing an invasion angle or something. I mean, wouldn't that have been hilarious?
Yeah. Now, what's his name? Shinji Sasazaki, right? Was their American agent type guy?
Yeah.
So I guess he would have set this up because he was based in Nashville, right?
Yes, I would think so.
One of my favorite wrestling stories, and I know our friend Tom K loves it, that he, as far as wrestling stories, I know they say that about everything, but as far as like guys getting weird, just weird guys exiting the business type stories, I mean, not that he did completely, obviously, but he stopped wrestling, that Shinji Sasazaki, who was in Memphis teaming with Hashimoto in 89 on their learning excursion, and he was he
Samurai.
Shogun? Was he Shogun? No, he was Samurai. That's right. Hashimoto was Shogun. Fell in love with Nashville, opened a sushi shop.
And stayed.
And yeah. I think he still lives there.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, he found true love and stayed in America.
Well, I think he did.
Go ahead.
I think he did meet someone and get married fairly,
yes.
Not long after he lived. Or was that why he stayed in the first place, that he met someone while he was in Memphis?
I think that's why he stayed in the first place. Okay. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, one of the interesting things with this story, I think, showed how ripe the American market was for shoot fighting like the UFC. And I think, if I recall correctly, the previous year there had been PWFG had done shows in Florida built around Bart Vale against Yoshiaki Fujiwara. And fans there seemed to really love the style there as well. So obviously there was a demand for something, much more, sort of something that was different than boxing, sort of closer to pro wrestling, but more stiff, more violence. Yeah.
Well, Florida kind of makes sense because Florida was a wrestling territory, for many years. You had you had Japanese guys that were very credible in Florida, like Matsuda, Misaito, guys like that. And of course, Carl Gotch was based in Florida. The Malinkos were based in Florida. That school was there. So, yeah, I'm sure the Tampa area was a great, place to have a show like that. So that makes sense to do a show there.
And Bart Vale, I believe, did a lot of local promotion with his martial arts students and his just all sorts of stuff like that. Which they
but yeah
they so they took a different path about it than UWFI did.
But yeah, you, You're right, though, Keith. I mean, it definitely shows that there was room for something different. That's for sure. So, and of course, a couple months later, we had the first UFC, and then the rest is history.
Well, and the first UWFI pay-per-view.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Did any idea why they didn't do this again, though, and why they didn't end up?
I have no idea.
Especially since they did have a fairly successful pay-per-view launch and with a lot of promotion. You know, wasn't it? It was the ads aired during football, right?
It aired. I remember that. Yeah.
Now, if I remember correctly, wasn't it also Johan Promotions that did that, who now does the UFC bar closed circuit deals?
Yes.
So, another one of those little connections there. But it's weird that they didn't do this again. I wonder if there was some heat with the boxing people because it got over so well or something like that.
I'm sure money was related. And now moving on to AAA, we're in Mexico. And not really a whole lot going on in Mexico this week compared to last show. Liz Mark defeated El Satanico at the AAA TV taping at the Gymnasio Juan de la Barrera in Mexico City in front of 6,500 fans on September 17th to retain his Mexican national light heavyweight title. Now, Bix, we saw Liz Mark and Satanico wrestle a lot on 80s matches and stuff like that. And, two really classic technicians. And it's I remember seeing this match on television. They tore the house down.
Yeah, this is an excellent match. I've seen people talk about it as if it was kind of underwhelming. And maybe it was compared to some of their best matches in the 80s. But they had an excellent match. It was also not the type of thing you saw that much in AAA at the time either.
No way.
Definitely.
Is it a brawling or high spots?
Right. I mean, this was a CMLL style match. I mean, these are two guys that are neither was really in. Actually, wait, how long did Liz Mark Sr. stay in AAA?
Liz Mark was in AAA longer than Satanico. Well, Satanico was in for a really short time period. He didn't fit in there.
Didn't fit in at all. And didn't they want him to do a different gimmick too?
Yes.
Or did he end up doing one? I'm trying to remember.
Yes.
What was he?
I
know he got re-gimmick.
Vamp for a minute while I'm trying to think about
it. I'm trying to remember. No, he wasn't Dracula, right? Who was Dracula? Dracula with a K. Dracula was MS-1?
Yes.
I think?
No, Satanico.
Or was he only Satanico? Why did I think he was
only Satanico.
Okay.
He was only Satanico.
So who was Dracula then? Not Heavy Dracula, just Dracula.
Oh, God. Wow, I can't remember.
But yeah, this is definitely the high point of Satanico and AAA. And
Massacre.
Yeah, okay, yes, it was Massacre.
That makes sense.
You were close. You missed one Massacre. You know, all infernales.
Yes. where was I? Yeah, so, and I guess you can even say, would you say it was also the high point in AAA for Liz Mark Sr.?
Yes.
Yeah, this is just a really, really, really good old school, you know, Lucha Libre title match style match. It just didn't, like I said, you didn't see this in AAA that much, if at all. And really not that much at all after this. I mean, I'm trying to think, like, even when they had title matches, they weren't always work title match style. I mean, I'm trying to think how many singles title matches they have on TV. Actually, you know what? No, but Santos Psicosis was worked like a title match, but I can't think of that many that were really in this style.
Not many at all, you're right. But Keith, you're AAA, this time they were, you know, a few weeks fresh from running the huge Los Angeles show. They were at pop, toe to toe, you know, they're right there, one of the best, maybe the best promotion in the world this time period.
Well, they were on fire at this point, pretty much. I suppose they were a bit hotter earlier in the year, building to the Conan versus Jen Karras Triple Mania one match. You know, and then Conan retired, and so I think we're in that period. You know, in that period before Conan comes back, so that probably explains why you know Liz Mark and El Satanico were headlining such a big show instead of someone like Conan.
Well, because you look, yeah, and then with Conan, I mean, yeah, he was gone, But I mean, there still were, you know, some, you know, big time names that were still around, like Santo and Ray was big at this time period.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, there were guys that were able to pick up the slack. But yeah, yeah, I mean, losing Conan, you know, for this time period was a big blow. But to their credit, like I said, they were still very strong.
Yeah, they definitely were.
Now, on the other side, MLL, not so much. They, in fact, got on Galavision again for 1 week and got taken off. And now AAA had 7 hours a week on Galavision. Based on what aired over that week, AAA was in the Thursday night, Friday morning time slot, 1 to 3 a.m. They were on that was it, matches from a year ago. Then they're on the 7 and 9 Saturday slot, which is the normal show. Then on the traditional 10 to 1 a.m. slot, which was, you know, EMLL plus 1 hour of AAA, but now it's become 2 hours of AAA and a final hour consisting of highlights. So they got a lot of television. But even with that, though, all three California shows were taped for television, but none have aired. Nor does it appear any of them will ever air, even though the group has now 7 hours of television per week, which sound on the surface sounds like an overexposure to the product. Now, the main show they aired this past weekend, instead of being from Los Angeles, was taped on September 7th in Monterey. Now, AAA has also debuted 1 week before in 21 European countries on cable with a two-hour weekly show on Sunday afternoons, making it the third international promotion following WWF and WCW to gain television exposure on that continent. Now, back to Los Angeles, the reason why that show hasn't aired on television yet is that Televisa is holding the tape to run in opposition to its rival network, Imavision, its fall season's hottest new show, which will debut in a few weeks. Now, Keith, did you ever see the AAA show in Europe?
So it was on satellite television because I remember sometimes watching it, but it was on a Spanish language channel. So it was very difficult for me to get into, you know, without knowing all the rules and everything that, you know. So, I mean, I did watch it a bit, but it didn't really leave much of an impact on me at the time.
And to be fair, a lot of people are the same way here when it comes to Lucha. They can't get into it because of the language barrier and all this other stuff. So you're not alone in thinking that way.
Well, I like Lucha now. I would say it's a hole in my, it's more of a hole in my view, because I think it takes a bit of getting used to the different style and the different rules. But I really like Lucha, but I think when I first started to watch it, particularly, you know, I was like 14 at the time, so I was used to just the WWF style. It's completely foreign.
Now, yeah. Bix, talk about the strategy there of running against Imavision with your Los Angeles shows.
Remind me what I'm trying to remember exactly, because I'm, without looking back to the notes, actually, like, I'm still a little confused as to what that meant without reading through it again.
I mean, what Imavision was starting a new hot show, which never was said what it was. So Galavision, in response, was going to air the AAA shows.
Oh, I thought you were saying something about a wrestling. Oh, okay. I thought you were saying something about a new wrestling show on Imavision.
No. Like a little confused.
Okay. Interesting. It shows how valuable AAA was.
Oh, yeah. Because Galavision was, you know, and still is, national network in Mexico that shows all kinds of programming, not just sports.
We should probably explain the distinction that there is, like, everyone always calls it in Televisa in America to sort of distinguish between the two. But the name of the network that in Mexico that aired the wrestling that was part of Televisa's family networks is, and well, not now because the situation kind of changed, but was Galavision. Was yes. Called Galavision. Channel yeah. 9, right?
Yeah. And, yeah, and then those Los Angeles shows, you've seen them, correct?
What, the was that with handheld?
Yes.
I don't know if I ever have.
Oh, it was awesome. I mean, those were awesome shows. And I can't remember if they ever even actually aired them on television, as a matter of fact.
I'm trying to think if any of them did.
I don't think they ever aired it. I could be wrong. I mean, this has been 20 years, 21 years ago, so I don't remember exactly. I have the handheld.
My gut says at least one did.
I have a handheld from the Los Angeles Sports Arena show, and that was, you know.
From which? The first one, La Revancha?
This is the 29th show. And I was 29th.
And, so is that La Revancha, or was La Revancha
and it did air on television because it's on YouTube.
Okay.
No, it's 28th. August 28th, excuse me.
Yeah.
So there are highlights on YouTube uploaded by our good friend Rob Bahari. And that was a show.
I knew there were handhelds around of them, but I don't think I had ever I didn't realize that they were circulating like in modern times that they were.
Yeah, okay. And to give you a hint of what it was, they drew 17,500 people at the sports arena. Packed that place out.
Turned away 8,000, I believe, was the number used?
$243,000 gate. And this was the triangle match between Conan, Jake, the Snake, and Sin Cara. That was basically a riot. I mean, the match only lasted 4:29. But, that feud was mega hot. You had Octagon, Santo, and Blue Panther against Love Machine 80 and Fuerza Guerrera. Psicosis, Heavy Metal, and Jerry Estrada against Volador, Rey Mysterio Jr., and Mysterioso. You had the Minis. I mean, it was a hot-ass show. And, yeah, quite a spectacle. So, again, like I said, AAA was just molten hot in this time period. And back to MLL, though, they did have one thing going on this week. On September 21st at Arena Coliseo, Emilio Charles Jr. kept the CMLL middleweight title by defeating El Dandy. And then we had a Parejas Suicidas match that ended up with Cachorro Mendoza going over Chamaco Balaguez, who got his head shaved. And the other participants in the match were Javier Cruz and Americo Rocca. Now, Bix, Charles and Dandy, I mean, have so many classes against each other. That's like a can't-miss match.
Yeah, I mean, they just had that style of those core CMLL guys that you think of being there for a long time. I mean, they all just kind of fit well with each other, just their style. So, like, a Dandy, Emilio Charles, Bestia Salvaje, you kind of get what I'm saying, those type of guys. I mean, they just something about their style. They were good brawlers. They could all work the mat. They were all kind of... They all had that kind of what meat and potatoes pro wrestler feeling about them, you know what I mean? Their personas and everything. So they just all really fit together, but they were all different enough too that it didn't clash from guys being too similar to each other either. They were distinct, but they all had styles that would enable them to have good chemistry.
Exactly. And Keith, I think El Dandy gets as big a raw deal as anybody in wrestling because, you know, we talk about this a lot. If you talk about El Dandy to your normal American wrestling fan over the, you know, that's been a fan for years, first thing to think of is, who are you to doubt El Dandy? You know, it's like a Bret Hart, but the man was one of the best workers of his era.
Yeah, El Dandy is a wrestler I really need to watch more of. I haven't seen much at all.
Everyone needs to watch
El Dandy. But I, you know, the people who say El Dandy is great, I really trust their opinions. So, you know, I think it's someone who I think if you like brawling more than high flying, you'll probably really love.
But he could do that flying style too. I mean, he could do everything. Dandy was just as great as a technico as he was a heel. He could do it all. A great performer.
I'm exposing how little I've seen of him there.
He was one of the best brawlers ever, though. I mean, he was fantastic in that role.
And a great mat wrestler.
Like I said, he could do it all.
I would say his flying relative to the era, like once he got into like the early 90s, that was probably his weakest spot, but it's not like he was bad at it. Yeah.
No, but watch him in the 80s.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. In the 80s, he's as good as... he's not the best, but he's as good as the next tier below the best.
Right.
But moving on to, we're talking about MLL having issues. We're going to the UWA, which is still alive, and they're having issues.
They're alive.
Yeah. The Shinmas are there, Hisashi and Hitsune Shinma. Of course, Hisashi Shinma is the former WWF president, New Japan president, UWF president, blah, 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 blah. They were at the UWA show on September 19th at El Torreo, and they gave Gran Hamada a plaque, and which is obviously a part of their business deal with him for the reopening of their new full promotion in December, which, of course, full is Federación Universal Lucha Libre.
Now, so wait, so is our full and Universal Lucha Libre technically supposed to be the same company, or were they different?
Technically the same, just with the F is involved in this time.
Okay. Because I didn't realize, I think for a long time I didn't realize that it was the same company. And now, didn't one of the Shinmas wrestle on a full card?
Yeah, Hisasune, yeah.
Yeah. Was that the only time that either of them wrestled?
Yes. Okay. Hisashi Shinma wouldn't wrestle nobody. You ever seen that guy? He wouldn't wrestle no one. But yeah, just, you know, the deal with Hamada, he was a UWA guy for many, many years. And again, this is just during the dying days of the UWA. So just a little footnote there. But on that note, we're going to take a quick break. Let the Place to Be boys pay the bills. And when we come back, we're coming home to America. And we're going to talk about Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert and his departure from ECW. And boy, is it juicy. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network. That's the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, Wrestling Culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
you can get the full archive of Good Will Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
We're back, and listen to all those shows that were just promoted in the break. They're all great. So listen to all of them, especially mine. But we're back with Between the Sheets, episode 9, talking September 15th to the 21st, 1994. And now we're back in America, and we're the fledgling ECW, still Eastern Championship Wrestling. And there's some big doings going on behind the scenes that spill out onto the show in front of the fans at September 18th on their Ultra Clash show at the ECW Arena in Philadelphia, which the Observer reported the standing room only attendance of 1,131 fans, which was the capacity was 960 in the arena, but it was $16,147 gate. But the Torch disputed those numbers, claiming 780 as the accurate attendance and less than that is paid. Now, regarding the show itself, the opening match saw this newly created tag team by Paul Heyman named Public Enemy, Rocco Rock and Johnny Grunge, defeating Ian Rotten and Jason Knight. Interesting there, the debut of Public Enemy. We'll talk about the show in general in a minute, but as go on, we have Terry Funk and Stan Hansen. That's right. Terry Funk and Stan Hansen in ECW. Defeating Kevin Sullivan and Abdullah the Butcher by DQ in a no DQ match. And step in 1 sec. Eddie Gilbert interfered for the DQ by hitting Funk with a chair. That led to a 5-minute post-match brawl where Funk climbed all over the scaffold, crotching himself on the bars of the scaffold, and tumbled down the side of the scaffold into the ring. Funk, Sullivan, and Abby all blading. During the post-match brawling, Sullivan began to hit Abby. Abby made his comeback. Then Johnny Hotbody entered and Abby beat him up, hot body bladed. Funk tried hard, but Sullivan and Abby are limited. Hansen was disappointing. Now, the main event of this show.
Is this Stan Hansen's last ever U.S. indie match?
I think so.
Last the main ever, event? Maybe even last ever American match. Oh, wait a second. When was the. Was he on one of the.
He was on the Amarillo show.
That's what I was going to say. The Funk's Amarillo show was after this, right?
Yeah, in November. Yeah. The Headhunters, it's the main event. The Headhunters defeated Crash the Terminator. Of course, Hugh Morris, Bill DeMott. And Miguel Perez Jr., when Crash was pinned after a moonsault at 8:38. This was the best match of the night. All four bled, some heavily. They brawled all over the building during and after the match. It was billed as a barbed wire baseball bat match, but somebody forgot the barbed wire. So promoters blamed its absence on an athletic commission ruling. The Hunters were great with the bat shots. At one point, one of the Hunters literally got thrown through a wall into the locker room. A really good brawl. The Hunters are major league material. This is, of course, from Dave. Now, before we get into the Eddie Gilbert stuff, any quick thoughts about this show, Keith?
Well, so I think it was really pretty much a two-match card. So, well, plus the debut of the Public Enemy. So that they were the real big things.
You didn't mention the scaffold
event.
Match.
Oh, no, yeah, the scaffold match, the bump by J.T. Smith. You know,
yeah, that, we didn't. I didn't bring that up. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
So wait, this was, I'm trying to remember, the angle was what, JT getting thrown out of the crow's nest by Dark Patriot that set this up?
Yes.
And then, or the eagle's nest. Didn't they use both names?
The eagle's nest.
But it was, I think it was crow's nest, then eagle's nest.
Yeah.
And so this led to Dark Patriot against JT Smith in a scaffold match, very high scaffold. And it was a real scaffold. It was not the the Tommy Dreamer, Brian Lee scaffold. Where it looked like they would die just from standing there because it was tied to the building supports or whatever the hell it was. It was a real regular pro wrestling type scaffold, and JT Smith did not take your ordinary scaffold match bump here. Actually, wait. JT... No, but Dark Patriot won, and then he... So he threw him off. I'm trying to remember, right? Like, he just chucked him off, like fully going off the cell, right? Would be the best comparison. Into the ring. Yeah. And then jumped off, and then Doug jumped off the scaffold with an elbow drop or something like that, right?
No, he didn't follow up. Because I watched Smith. Well,
go ahead.
I thought you were saying that Doug Gilbert jumped off with an elbow drop afterwards.
Didn't he do some kind of dive off the scaffold onto Smith?
No, he... So, I'm sure if I'm remembering what happened correctly. So, he sort of came down afterwards, and there was... he sort of attacked him with a chair, and, you know, the fans told him... The fans were chanting at him, Dark Patriot, to jump, but he didn't do that.
Oh, okay, that might be what I'm thinking. Why do I think I've seen him jump off?
Well, why would Doug Gilbert jump, you know, considering what's happening behind the scenes?
That's a good point.
He's not a moron. But yeah, JT Smith, quite the crazy bump taker over the years.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Although the first ECW blown dive was not intentional, right?
No, it wasn't. No, but it wasn't. And this is a different era of ECW too. I mean, this is
very much.
I mean, yeah, Paul Heyman is just really getting his influences in, and. And I guess we'll go ahead and hit on it. During the intermission, Eddie Gilbert gave a speech saying farewell to his fans. Now, he was a heel now, saying he was pursuing other interests. He was trying to sell his wrestling gear, $200 for his boots, $70 for his tights, $150 for his ring jacket. He said how proud he was to be the king of Philadelphia, and he left. The fans popped for him as he left, and this whole deal infuriated Heyman, who didn't want Gilbert to cut a live promo. It was said that the heat between the two were red hot. Now, largely the split up between Eddie Gilbert and ECW, described by Todd Gordon, was amicable. It's because Gordon is likely to become the Northeastern regional promoter if, when Jim Crockett Jr. starts up a promotion after his no-compete clause with WCW expires in December. Gilbert is expected to return home to Tennessee and get involved in state politics. Gordon has yet to decide whether or not he'll simply promote a Crockett product, which may or may not go by the World Wrestling Network name. Yes, there was a World Wrestling Network back then. Or he'll promote in conjunction doing a split television show, which, for instance, may include him adding 15 minutes of locally produced matches, interviews, and angles, and continuing the ECW to a national show. Now, Bix, Eddie Gilbert gave a very in-depth interview to Wrestling Flyer on September 24.
John Clark's newsletter.
John Clark's newsletter. And he talked about everything in depth. So the floor is now yours to tell everyone what really was going on.
Jesus, I don't even know where to start. Because there were all sorts of rumors and stuff. So, like, let's see. Where do we start here? Okay, so we get the first ECW part is... You know, what kind of agreement were you on to come in? It was $13.50 a week for 6 months, and at the end they'd take a look at it again, and that then he'd move up or something, and first it was... I don't know. So he also brought in Kevin Lawler as his, I guess, officially assistant booker, but technically his lackey.
Yeah,
Which Kevin was not happy about, because he thought he was actually going to be the assistant booker. There were rumors that he was offered part of the company.
49%.
Yeah, 49%. And there were just all sorts. But then there were rumors that Terry Funk was trying to get him the book in WCW. And then people thought he would go to WWF because Lawler was there. And just all sorts of stuff was happening. But he said that Todd Gordon did actually offer him the 49% and he didn't take it. Or he did. I can't tell what he's saying here.
But yeah, get to the Heyman stuff, though. That's where all a lot of the juice is.
Well, let's start with... why don't we start with the story as it's been told over the years?
Okay.
So the way it's sort of framed by most of the time is Heyman kind of, once he's getting there, taking the lay of the land... Seeing there's something he can make of this when really probably no one else thought they could, and trying to move Eddie out. The sort of more evolved version and the version you hear from Heyman is that Eddie was too far gone on drugs and stuff, and that Todd was firing him, and because he was there and he was the guy who could book, having been Eddie's assistant in various different places, that he was the natural guy to offer the job to, and he took it, and Eddie saw that as a betrayal. Would that be the best way to put it?
Yeah, I also think that the fact that he was trying to sell his wrestling gear, you know, doesn't like reflect well on his shape at the time.
Although he did,
and he also looked really rough. You know, yeah, he didn't look good. You know, when he ran in the sort of main event. Well, not the main event, the bunkhouse match with all the big national stars, Funk, Hanson, Abby, and Sullivan.
Yeah, that's right. And although he was actually, I mean, the thing with him trying to go into local politics is real. I mean, you know, somewhere online there is or was a scan of like one of his political flyers for whatever what was it that he ran for?
He was running for the clerk.
County clerk. Yeah, I guess Lexington, Tennessee.
Yeah.
And he did lose. He was running as a Republican. But I mean, that was actually a thing that happened. He did actually take time off from wrestling to try to do that. I mean, that it's not like that was just a cover for him and whatever issues he might have had. Jesus, I can't even remember. This whole thing is just so...
The thing about Heyman is he's bitter at Heyman because Heyman, he's the one that pretty much made Paul Heyman as far as in the wrestling business. I mean, yeah, Heyman had the run with Idol and Rich, but it's the Continental stuff. Well, I mean, he was in AWA too. It's the Continental stuff that really got Paul hot. And, you know, they had the deal in WCW when they were together, and they had the problems there with Flair. And
right, it was the Continental stuff that made him more of a commodity. Yeah. I mean, and he was a good manager, but he became a commodity off Continental.
Yeah, and now Paul Heyman is, you know, in ECW, pretty much thanks to Eddie, and Paul is kissing Jim Crockett's ass. You know, he's trying to make the play. And Todd, in the way Eddie perceives it, is Todd Gordon is a mark wrestling promoter who is marking out over Jim Crockett. And Paul is trying to push Eddie out, so Todd's not taking Eddie's side, and Eddie's just being caught in it. And you can see where Eddie's pissed off because Eddie had really done some really good things with that promotion in 93.
He was definitely burnt out as a booker, but he did do some good stuff there, yeah.
But the thing about Eddie is, though, is that was part of it, but you add that on top of all the stuff that was going on where he was thinking that maybe he would get back in WCW as a booker if Terry Funk got the job as president. Think about that now, folks. Think about Terry Funk would have got Bischoff's job, how different things would have been in WCW. That's a whole nother deal. But, I mean, Eddie thought that was coming. And the WF stuff was all just talk. I mean, that was just people shooting rumors out. But, I mean, it was
although Terry Funk then was supposed to go to WWF right around this time, too.
Yeah, yeah, Terry Funk was, there was rumor to go there.
I don't, but I thought that was actually supposed to happen, that he was supposed to replace Patterson.
That was taught, but, you know, it never really got to be serious, as far as I know.
And wasn't that the whole "I can't do it, my horse is sick" story?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's just real weird. And, of course, Jim Crockett at WCW, Eddie Gilbert was like the only one that would listen to Jim Crockett when Jim Crockett was sitting at home as a paid consultant. And, you know, he was feeling like Jim Crockett is screwing him over, you know, because Eddie's the one that went to bat for having the War Games brought back as a gimmick in 1989. Jim Crockett gave him that, told him that to use that idea when nobody else would listen to Jim, and then Eddie fought for it and got the War Games on the Great American Bash Tour. So,
all in all, though, Eddie does describe this as a much more amicable split than you hear about it being these days.
Yeah, but Paul Heyman did not want him out there with the mic.
No, but he describes this as, like, he doesn't, he makes it out. I mean, the whole, because the interview is not just about this. I mean, it ran across two issues. It talks about all, you know, the entirety of his career, et cetera.
Yeah.
But he I mean, obviously the timing was this, but, you know, John Clark did interviews like every issue. That was his thing. But he makes it out to be relatively amicable. But, like, you can tell he's acting like he's kind of miffed by it, but he's not as upset as history has made him out to be, which, who knows?
Yeah, but the thing is, you hear the story, well, Heyman's saying backstage, you know, this is Jim Crockett's show. This is Jim Crockett's show to Todd Gordon, and Gordon's like, I beg your pardon? You know, right when, you know, Eddie's out there talking, you know. I mean, it's just...
Well,
it's
Paul was Crockett's boy leading up into this, because he...
Yeah, he went to the NWA convention with, you know, as his guy. As his, second in command.
It's now a good time to talk about whether or not we believe Paul's account of what happened during this period and what he gave up to go to work with Crockett and then ECW.
I mean, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
The whole Paul Jim Crockett deal is just so intriguing.
You know, I'm talking about him having a contract with William Morris Endeavor. William Morris Agency then to get a show on Mix 105 opposite Howard Stern.
I don't believe none of that shit. I think that's all. I never have believed that.
I just don't understand how we could have never heard about something like that before.
I don't pay that any credence.
I believe he was living off the WCW settlement and then got in with Crockett with the type of thing he said, like that he was just sitting at home and Crockett just kind of dared him, like, you know, what was it that, like, I'm glad to see you're just one of those guys that's all talk. It was something like that that Crockett said to him. I believe that happened because Paul was just sitting at home living off a big settlement from WCW.
Yeah. But then, of course, the whole deal with this fell apart.
With the WWN.
And Crockett eventually would run. You know, they ran shows.
And we talked about that a little last week, too.
Yeah, after the fact, but... Yeah, and then, of course, ECW was a member of NWA, of course.
Eastern Championship Wrestling.
The tournament the next year where Shane threw down the title, so just a wild deal. And Eddie had his demons. We all know that. But it sounds like in this instance, he was, you know, far from the one that was the problem.
Paul was better suited to book that promotion, though, in terms of he had a better idea, I think, what to do with those guys that they had and how to book a Northeastern indie promotion that compared to what Eddie was trying to do with it. But, yeah.
And see, Eddie didn't want to go to the show to begin with. He had sent Doug up there with all the finishes.
Right.
But they demanded Eddie show up, and he did. And got that promo. So, go ahead.
It's not like he hadn't done something similar before.
Oh, no. And that's Eddie's problem is, in situations like this, all the other issues come up. And, you know, it's kind of like the boy that cried wolf in a lot of ways, which is sad.
Yeah, I mean, if we think about it, you know, so the Continental was the first, right?
Yeah.
Continental was the first, and who knows... Who knows who was actually right in that whole argument with him and David Woods? Then WCW with the booking job, where he got fired. Although that was probably more of a Flair political thing.
Yeah.
That one probably not as much of his fault. Then the way he left WCW as a wrestler was absolutely his fault.
Yeah.
Where he claimed to have a shoulder injury and that he was going to retire or whatever it was and went to Memphis after he got his release. I don't know why they were dumb enough to not give him to give him an unconditional release, but that's another story.
I don't think they cared.
And then I'm trying to remember, was there anything between that and this? Wing
Global.
Oh, right, because he took the belt with him.
Yeah, and Wing, of course, for him and Doug Unmasked and all that stuff.
Although Doug was actually the one that took the initiative with that, at least on the mic. And then USWA with the I am the USWA promo that got him fired. Yeah. And then Smoky Mountain. I mean, this was
Smoky Mountain's after the fact.
No, that's what I'm saying though. I mean, but that everything, just how many times he did it.
Yeah, it's just a shame. Guy had so much talent, and in the non wrestling part, I mean, we all know he's great in the ring, but as a, you know, in the booking department, I mean, the guy had some serious talent. Just
he had such a distinctive creative style to his booking.
Yeah,
that I feel like his shows are not really like anyone else's, and I always thought it was just bullshit the way some people, especially Heyman, put it. And, you know, I put something about this in the Fighting Spirit article I did about him, that that I don't like the way he's written off as this guy that just redid the angles he saw in Memphis when he grew up. Like, that's not him. I mean, that's like this. Yeah, you can say ECW was that because of the whole King of Philadelphia thing, that was him playing Lawler. But
that's his idol.
Yeah. But also, I mean, you think of all the famous Eddie Gilbert angles, which he either was the booker or given free, something he was given free reign with by the booker and something he booked himself. They're not repeats of old angles. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, the Russian flag, the Tommy Rich Tag Team of the Year thing, the, you know, whatchamacallit, the, you know, the Tom Pritchard Dirty White Boy thing, which he, Pritchard and Tony Anthony actually came up with, but which still he, you know, approved. I mean, that was...
And all that stuff you're talking about now is covered in this interview, and it's all interesting to read him describing that stuff, because he did that fight angle just to tear up the Continental set, because he didn't want the set no more.
Yeah, I love that story.
So he told him to destroy the set. And regarding Memphis, and it's something I didn't really know until the fact is that, you know, hired Tom Renesto.
Yeah, in 85. Yeah, I didn't know that until I read this either.
But Eddie, you know, Jerry wanted Eddie to be the booker. But he then hired Tom Renesto. And Eddie had told him anyway that Ricky Morton had been going to bat for him for the Mid-South. So he says he's going to go to Mid-South anyway.
Right, because it was like, if I can't book, I should go making more money somewhere.
Yeah,
and then Jared said, "Well, when you come back, you can be the booker," which kind of happened.
It kind of happened, but although he wasn't technically the booker when he came in.
Yeah, but in 88. he had input.
Well, you watch the shows, you can tell. I mean,
yeah, and that was in 1988. But yeah, I mean, he, you know, 3 years later, but yeah, you could tell that Eddie had some power.
Well, the shows were built around the Gilbert family.
Yeah. And yeah. The story about Missy Hyatt, you know, and the depression that she had when they were pushing Woman so hard, and Missy Hyatt would get out of the bed. I mean, it's a very interesting interview. I think we may need to put that out there as a companion to this show.
I mean, yeah, I think we should.
Yeah, it's really
because
really
it's very intriguing, very intriguing stuff.
And I feel like almost in some ways it's more candid than the shoot interview video he did with Bob.
Oh yeah, yeah, way more. Yeah, he's definitely more. You know, like I say, candid is a great word with Clark. That's no doubt.
Well, what I thought was interesting, how I interpret things, was that he wasn't that unhappy with Todd Gordon because he viewed him as being manipulated by...
Yeah, he's a bar promoter. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I always... So how I've always interpreted this was that I think he, yeah, he obviously didn't want Jim Crockett Jr. to be involved in his promotion.
No.
And I think he always thought that Paul Heyman, because he had stood up for him, you know, in shoot interviews when WCW suspended him, that Heyman should have walked out with him, sort of thing, or, you know, not have been taking Jim Crockett Jr.'s side on things. He should have been backing Gilbert.
Well, the thing with Crockett, real quick, Keith, is he mentions this in the interview, is he said that Crockett was wanting to, you know, he was in Ty Gordon's ear saying, "We're going to take ECW to Baltimore. We're going to take it to Washington, D.C. You know, he wanted to expand it out. Meanwhile, Eddie was more wanting to keep it in just in the Philly area.
Yeah. And one other thing that I thought was interesting was, you know, in contrast with how he was describing Todd Gordon, was that he was very complimentary about Eric Bischoff, but was sort of putting the seeds, you know, if he ever happened to read, you know, the Wrestling Flyer, you know, putting the seed maybe in Bischoff's mind that he needed someone there who would open his eyes up to all the office politics that was going on at the time.
Well, so, in fairness, the Bischoff was Eddie Gilbert had no relationship with Bischoff at all.
Yeah, yeah,
he was long gone before Bischoff got there.
I thought it was interesting though because it seemed like he was sort of angling for a job with WCW in the interview.
Oh,
that's
he was.
How it came off to, with. That's how I interpreted it.
But with Flair there, it was never going to happen.
Although, yeah. Was Flair booking yet?
Yes.
He was, okay.
Yes. No, Dusty is. But Flair's got power.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not the head booker yet, but Dusty is, because this is Dustin time, which we'll talk about as the show goes on. But, yeah, Flair's got power, though. He's got play. But we're going to move on to a whole another subject. We're going to, speaking of dying territories, Global Wrestling Federation. And they have lost their television slot on KTVT in Dallas on Channel 11, as Channel 11 refused to comment on why the station dropped the show when the deal was that GWF would be paying them $5,000 a week to pay it to air. The program director said ratings weren't a factor, which they usually aren't when it comes to paid programming. So that's an interesting little deal. Now, GWF also has cut the number of comp tickets down from 100,000. That's right. They would given out 100,000 tickets a week to 1,000, but at least a greater percentage came and paid attendance was the highest in recent memory, as 744 fans attended, but 288 were paid. Now, GWF may have lost as much as $2,000 because of concession sales and parking because of having 744 as opposed to 1,500 in the building. Even with the added customers increasing the average house from about $500 to $1,600, nevertheless, all those free tickets all over town was making it nearly impossible for anyone to draw in Dallas, since the perception of wrestling was that it wasn't something you paid to see. Now, on that show on September 17th, John Hawk, who we know and love as Bradshaw, JBL, had the tasteless line of the week saying the Freebirds are gone and all the Von Erichs are dead, so I'm taking over. It wouldn't have been so bad had not Kerry Von Erich's two daughters been in the building. Yikes.
Well, now, it's not like he wouldn't get in trouble for political incorrectness in WWE eventually. Yeah, doing the was it the Hitler salute in Europe?
Yeah, Bradshaw's been one of these guys that he's done a lot of stuff in wrestling before thinking about it.
That's a good way of putting
it. I mean, shooting on the Blue Meanie.
Yeah, that's pretty bad stuff. But Bix, the GWF business model this time, regarding the ticket giveaway, and I love the line about the perception of wrestling was that wasn't something you paid to see. Classic.
Now, in fairness to Gray Pearson, though, or whoever it was, I think it was Gray Pearson. He owned the concession. We've talked about this before.
Yeah, he was in charge. Yeah,
he owned the concession rights and the parking. He got paid on the parking, so. It was not as ridiculous as it necessarily sounds. I mean, this did have the details, but he sometimes gets a bad rap for it when he shouldn't necessarily. For this specifically. Yeah, I mean,
GWF really sucked at this time period.
Oh, God. I'm trying to remember. Were they still on ESPN in any form? Was ESPN
on They were on ESPN, too.
Okay.
Here's the card for that show.
Oh, God.
Kendo Nagasaki over Mike Diamond, Moa Deeb, Ahmed Johnson, this is very early in his run, over Bam Bam Richardson and Johnny Dollar. Then we have Awesome Kong going to a no contest with Crazy Mike Davis. Alice Porto beats Stephen Dane. The Tribal Nation, Chris and Mark Youngblood over Black Bart and John Hawk. And your main event, and what a main event this is, Scott Putski. Battled Iceman Parsons to a double countout. Yeah. And they ran a split show that night. They ran Belton, Texas, same night. Here's the car for that show. Tugboat Taylor over Bullman Downs. Guido Falcone over Chaz Taylor. Tarzan beat Rick Gonzalez. Falcone and Vito Mussolini over Action Jackson and Chaz Taylor. Killer Tim Brooks over Chris Barrett. Chris Adams over Rob Price by DQ. And Chris Adams wins a battle royal. Notice those names. I mean, those names were all the Texas shows in this time period. And that's one of the main reasons why all the Texas promotions had problems, because they kept using the same old stale talent. It's just ridiculous.
But this is my favorite name of those guys, just because it's like, why? I just, that whole thing, like the name, and that he was, you know, like that he was just, it's not like he was any good or anything. He was just always there.
Yeah. A constant.
What was his real name? Am I confusing him with something else? No, I was confusing him with Dog of War for a second, but that was another guy who was there forever.
Yeah, it's same old guys, you know. Just a sad state of affairs in Texas. But going to a place that wasn't a sad state of affairs, Smoky Mountain Wrestling. And on the September 17th show in Johnson City, Tennessee, the Black Ninja defeated Bob Armstrong in a match where either Bob Armstrong or Jim Cornette would have to leave SMW. This proved to be very anticlimactic for most fans, since everyone was expecting Cornette's mystery wrestler to be Yokozuna, Terry Funk, Shawn Michaels, or someone similar in that magnitude. The Ninja turned out to be jobber Larry Santo under a mask. Bob dominated the brief match, sending Cornette into a panic since he would have to leave if Ninja lost. Finally, Cornette jumped into the ring and drew back to hit Bob with his tennis racket, but before he could land the blow, referee Mark Curtis saw the weapon. Cornette then began arguing with Curtis. Bob locked on the sleeper, Cornette from behind. While the referee tried to break this up, a new Ninja, Brian Armstrong, ran in and switched places with the original Ninja, who was dazed. The fresh Ninja then clobbered Bob from behind and scored the pin. The crowd was shocked that Bob lost. The prevailing opinion among the casual fans had been that Cornette's man would lose and Cornette would leave SMW to work full-time for the WWF. Not much to the match other than a little drama. Now, basically what this was setting up was a return of the Bullet.
Yeah.
Bob under the mask, which had been done in Knoxville, you know, for Continental for years. So now you're bringing that gimmick back. So, interesting. I mean, SMW, I said they were really hot this time period and doing some good stuff, but I think that's not the best move to do when you have promote this big mystery wrestler and then bring out, you know, Larry Santo under a mask. Big. So, I mean, this is like a crack starting to show in SMW.
Yes, but to be fair, he's actually ripping off something WWF did 5 years earlier on Saturday Night's Main Event in the featured match, no less. Technically. So, it's been done.
Yeah, but again, I mean,
and with a better worker.
Yeah, you're promising something, though, and you're not just...
No, absolutely. I mean, this is the beginning of their problems with stipulations.
No, only... Go ahead, Keith.
But the Black Ninja never returned. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Because it's just like, was one and done. Like, yeah, I could sort of understand it if you're debuting, like, you know, them as a tag team. You know, like the two Black Ninjas. Yeah, but just bringing someone in under a mask, it's a bit of a rip-off. He could have probably done more with it, maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's also weird because they brought in a similar character a few months later anyway.
Yeah.
Which was Tim Horner as Kendo the Samurai.
Exactly. Again, this is just, I don't know, it was a creative mind block from Cornette. So, yeah, just interesting. Now, the September 18th episode of Smoky Mountain Wrestling, which was taped on the 13th in Oakwood, Virginia, Jim Cornette debuted as Smoky Mountain Commissioner after Terry Funk defeated Bob Armstrong in Knoxville on September 12th, and the commissionership only lasted a couple of weeks before Les Thatcher had him impeached.
Wasn't it just one episode?
No, it was like two episodes.
Which is so I thought so. It's which is the Dark Secret, the one with Candido versus Dark Secret, the first or the second?
It was second one.
Okay, because I know, I remember, I thought, I was thinking it was one episode. I remember Cornette coming out in the tuxedo or whatever it is, with the, and then looking Candido versus
this episode
Archie.
Is, yeah, this episode, this is what happened. Cornette took credit for the Steiners losing their tag titles to the Quebecers, and he showed filming the Heavenly Bodies attacking them, leading to the Steiners coming to Smoky Mountain for revenge, with them bringing their dog Arnold in to neutralize Cornette, which they came in on October 7th.
Cornette loved Arnold.
Yeah.
So he loved that idea of Arnold chasing him around ringside.
Yeah. Tracy Smothers announces that he's bringing a sensational Sherry to counter Tammy Fitch. And Dirty White Boy finally finds Ron Wright, but only after Brian Lee and Tammy rolled him out in his wheelchair, saying that Ron was moving in with them so they could take care of him. Which is a great angle, by the way. Because Ron Wright's like in love with Tammy in a way, so.
And at this, and then he starts to become like actual sick, confused old man because they're neglecting him.
Yeah.
So, and then, because they
which leads to a great, yeah, the great angle when they reunite Ron Wright with Dirty White Boy
and as baby faces, yeah,
as baby faces.
Now they found it. Now you said they found him. Was he with Stan Hansen?
No. No, he was looking for him because they supposedly he was like in a ditch.
I screwed up the joke. I should have said they were looking for him. Was he with Stan? I'm terrible tonight.
So he was in a ditch. Dirty White Boy thought he might be in a ditch somewhere and all this other stuff. So he's really worried. And all of a sudden he comes out with Brian Lee and Tammy. But yeah, I mean, Smoky Mountain Television this time was really strong. But when you start reading in on those stipulations, that's not good. Definitely not good at all. And the Steiner Brothers were pretty fun in their Smoky Mountain appearances. I will say that.
And wasn't the angle that you were talking about with the bodies attacking the Steiners one of those WWF taping angles that only airs in Smoky Mountain or USWA?
Yes. Pretty much. So, yeah, that's what's going on in Smoky Mountain at the time. Now, across the state, in Memphis, we have our Lord and Savior, Vince McMahon, opening up the live show on WMC with a tape promo wearing the Unified Heavyweight title around his waist. Now, he's wearing his Vince suit with the belt around his waist, saying that the belt now belongs to WWF because Tatanka had beaten Jerry Lawler for the title on September 13th at Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis. But it only lasted a week as Lawler pinned Tatanka in an elimination match on September 20th, where the title could change hands if he pinned your rival. The match was Lawler, Jeff Jarrett, and the Moondogs over, here's all your champions, Tatanka, Unified Champion, Tommy Rich, USWA Champion, and the Dog Catchers, Jimmy Stone and Jeff Sword, as your tag team champions. Now, Vince was supposed to appear on that show, accompanying Lex Luger for a match, but Luger was still nursing a back injury. Now, Vince McMahon in Memphis was fantastic. We may have talked about this before in brief, but...
I think we did. You know, as always, advise everyone, look up McMemphis on YouTube.
Yeah, look up McMemphis. Awesome. Everything is on there. Our buddy Tim Evans, Timmy8271, put that up there.
And
so
that one Vince promo with the belt, too, is maybe the highlight of that whole run, too.
Yeah, he just very subtly raises his arm up where his jacket can come undone. So you see the belt around his waist.
I mean, it's just fantastic. Kind of the same promo he did when they stole the skull belt from Austin.
Yeah.
And it's basically the same thing.
Yeah. It's just fantastic stuff. We could see back then that Vince was a natural. And it would have been funny to see if Vince would have been a performer earlier on.
I think the perhaps the timing doesn't work out. Right. I mean, it was perfect timing after Montreal. That it was a good thing they didn't do it, you know, before, really, because, it was sort of lightning in a bottle. You couldn't get a perfect setup to turn Vince McMahon heel, you know, and it was a shoot as well. You know, it was sort of amazing. But, I mean, you know, Vince is just really awesome. Like, you know, I mean, he was a natural heel. Like, there's a later promo where he said, he was sort of, making fun of the Memphisians for, sort of believing in the Tooth Fairy, and, also said at the end of the promo, there's only three things you can guarantee in life: death, taxes and Macho Man Randy Savage he was bringing in. But it was how he said it and also his face. It was just like perfectly maniacal. It was just awesome.
You know what would have been great if Vince was more self-aware? So like Eddie, there are three things in life that you can guarantee. Death, taxes, and anything can happen in the World Wrestling Federation.
And the deal about Vince was he's getting out his aggressions in this promo from what's going on in real life, too. I mean, these promos at this time period. So.
Which is the grand jury.
Yeah. So that's one good thing for him. Now, we're still in USWA, and the Spellbinder made his debut on September 13th at Mid-South Coliseum. And Wade Keller reported that it was Del Wilkes in the gimmick who was the Patriot.
Wasn't that in the Observer that week, too?
I think Dave had reprinted it from somebody else.
But they both had it as Del Wilkes.
Yeah. Well, he got the Del part right, as Del it was Rios. Del Rios, Harry Del Rios. But Spellbinder worked as Fantasia in WWF, and I mean, the gimmick was a cool gimmick, but...
For a wrestler, he was a hell of a magician.
Exactly. That's a great line about that. But moving on.
He was not bad later on when he was Elijah, at least on promos.
Yeah. Well, moving on to Larry Sharp's WWA. And while we're doing that, here's why. On September 18th in Elizabeth, New Jersey at the Dunn Sports Center, Dennis Corluzzo and Larry Sharp promoted the combined NWA-WWA benefit car for Make-A-Wish. Elizabeth Police Department sponsored the car, and according to Corluzzo, more than 1,800 fans were in the building, including 350 executive tickets, which sold for $50 apiece. The executive tickets were sold by police officers to local business people. The other 1,500 tickets were sold to public thanks to publicity through posters around town and cable television advertising. Big Boss Man and Dick Murdoch was the main event, where Big Boss Man going over. Boss Man was said to have his working shoes on, and he got a huge pop from the crowd. From WWF exposure. Murdoch threw now some of his more infamous drop kicks and worked well with Boss Man. So you got hard working Dick Murdoch that night. Boss Man ended up pinning Murdoch after stealing a nightstick from him and knocking out Nails. That's right, for the pin. Then on the other card, you had guys like Ed the Razor over Ray Odyssey, Cousin Luke over Chris Evans, Nails over Striker.
No, Convict Nails.
Convict Nails. Boy Gone Bad over Chuck Worthington, who would become Chaz.
Well, saying Charles Worthington. That's his real name.
And before the match began, three terminally ill children were granted.
No, his real name. No, Chaz Warrington is his real name.
Yeah. Before the match began, three terminally ill children were granted a wish of having a private party with wrestlers. Now, here are your wrestlers: Nails, Cousin Luke, Dick Murdoch, and Coco Ware. Among local wrestlers, but Boss Man stole the show. WWF donated a box of merchandise, which was given to the kids, and Boss Man invited three kids ringside with him to be his honorary managers. He also took down their addresses and phone numbers and promised to correspond with him. Quote, "It was the most fun I've had since these two shows are promoted in Minnesota," said Corluzzo. "In fact, it's the only fun I've had in the business since those shows. It really was a lot of fun." Now, this building was used as a location for WWF TV tapings for years, with a capacity of 4,000 people. There's potential for future success in the location. Although Corluzzo attributes a lot of the success of the show to the cooperation of the police and the charities. Quote, "The real important thing is that the charities made money and the kids were happy," unquote. That alone made the show a success. But those in attendance had a good time, too. When Boss Man came out, it was like Hulk Hogan. It was an energetic, successful night, unquote.
I really want to see that main event.
Yeah, Boss Man and Murdoch sounds like a really fun match, especially if Murdoch's got his working boots on.
And Boss Man was still really, really good here. Because had he started in All Japan yet?
Yes.
And he
was right before he goes to WCW.
I mean, he was on fire there.
Yeah.
He was very good.
He was definitely trying to make a point. That's no doubt.
If people have never seen his All Japan stuff from this run, I mean, even his stuff is his first run as Big Bubba in 87, which was pretty good, but he's better here. I mean, he was just like the match against Kobashi and the match against even Akira Taue. Like, he works very well together. And the tag matches, too, because he was. Who was he teaming with, Doc or Hanson? It was Doc, right?
Yes.
And they were worked really well together. They were a good team. Although go ahead.
It's really weird him wrestling in his Bossman gear, though, in Japan.
Well, they're calling him Big Bubba, too.
Yeah.
Although, wasn't he just Big Bubba and not Big Bubba Rogers because they didn't want to give someone an R name?
Yeah.
Which then, of course, memorable for them because it sounds like they're Japanese, so they're pronouncing the hard U, so they keep calling him Big Booba.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, now on the NWA, which, yeah, the NWA was around.
Technically.
Technically, but...
Literally just technically.
This really ties into WCW, though, in a lot of ways, as the NWA has tried to get an injunction on September 15th, forcing WCW to have Rick Rude, or whoever they would have as their NWA champion, lose the belt to someone the NWA board of directors would choose by January 31st, 1994. Now, WCW legal counsel presented a letter that was drawn up by Bill Watts and Seiji Sakaguchi from the year before, which said that the rights of usage of the NWA title and all other associations with it belong to WCW. Sakaguchi also approved the title belt itself being sold to WCW in February when Barry Windham became the champion. The NWA legal counsel led by Robert Trowbridge and Ed Lyons disputed the validity of the letter, claiming a conflict of interest involving Watts, saying that it was an inside job between Watts and Sakaguchi. The NWA board thinks the letter will be found invalid. Meanwhile, WCW spokesman Mike Weber told The Torch that the NWA name would no longer be used with WCW and actually start on September the 1st. What this means is that the NWA members can use the NWA name, but they must win a legal battle with WCW to force them to take the title off of Rude.
Well, the physical belt.
Yeah, because as of now, they don't have those rights. If the NWA wants a true NWA World Heavyweight Champion, they would have to either award the title to someone or hold a tournament, which would be the second time in as many years the official lineage of the title would be disrupted. The last time was when Ric Flair was stripped of the title while in WWF. In WCW, the member of the NWA held a tournament in Japan to decide a new champion. The top names being thrown around to become the future champion are Terry Funk, Ted DiBiase, and Road Warrior Hawk. Now that's coming from The Torch. Now we go to The Observer. On September 15th in a Charlotte courthouse, in a series of scenes more reminiscent of a television drama than what would expect real life to be like, the NWA, a group of several of those worldwide, but only one of whom at present even has so much as a television show, and none that run a full-time promotion, were attempting to gain a temporary restraining order against WCW to keep them from advertising the Ric Flair-Rick Rude match as a World Heavyweight title match of any kind. The NWA believed it should be the match, and the result take place as scheduled, create the idea among wrestling fans that Rick Rude was the NWA champion, since Rude was scheduled to win the belt synonymous with the title, and which had up to 1 week before the event had been billed as a match for the NWA championship. On September the 1st, WCW withdrew as a member of the NWA. The NWA board of directors, which by the NWA bylaws controls and has the decision-making power over the NWA World Heavyweight title, refused to sanction the title change, and at their annual convention on September 3rd, decided to take control of the championship and create a new champion. Okay. Currently, the belt Rude holds is not officially the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. He was officially stripped of the title status when WCW resigned on September the 1st.
To jump in for a second just to say that this was written after Rude had won the title, although Flair was the champion when this happened, but they had shot the Rude stuff at Disney months in advance. I just wanted to clear that part up because I don't know if that comes up, and that was what the original heat was over in the first place. So,
yeah. All right, WCW does have legal claim to the actual belt. Critics question, though, what all the fuss is about in the first place. Without a full-time territory, the NWA board fighting for the rights to a championship seems premature. However, World Wrestling Network officials would like to have the worldwide recognition of the NWA name. Several of the NWA members were led to believe an out-of-court settlement was reached in principle on September 14th. When WCW led NWA lawyer Ed Lyons to believe they were accepting NWA's proposal that would allow WCW to go through with a Flair Rude title change, provided WCW agrees to have Rude drop the title clean to an NWA wrestler on either NWA house show before January 31st, 1994, which we talked about earlier. There were several other provisions as well, which included WCW being forbidden to do anything that would discredit the NWA name or title and would give the NWA possession of the championship belt. If Rude wouldn't do the clean job to a wrestler of the NWA's choosing, WCW would agree to pay the NWA $100,000 per day in damages. That's insane. Early next morning,
they wish that happened.
Yeah, good luck. Early next morning, the NWA lawyers were told that there might be a problem because WCW was concerned that Rude wouldn't agree to do the job. And obviously, if that was the case, the price for that in daily penalties was way too steep. The counteroffer was made that the Flair-Rude match would be billed as being for the World Heavyweight title. and the result of the match would go as planned, but then on the broadcast, the announcers would read a disclaimer that this match wasn't an NWA World Heavyweight title match, and that the NWA did not sanction this event as a title match, which apparently the NWA was still willing to accept. Later that morning, WCW pulled out from negotiating the settlement and announced that it hired Faison Hicks to represent them in the court case for the temporary restraining order scheduled for that afternoon. Hicks had represented both the NWA and WCW in a 1991 case that won against Vince McMahon in the WWF over the NWA belt, which resulted in a judge ruling that Ric Flair could no longer wear or either the NWA belt or a facsimile of the NWA belt.
Which we just talked about last week.
In the aftermath of that case, Flair was paid $28,000 by WCW for his title belt, which Kip Fry and Seiji Sakaguchi agreed to use to revive the NWA titles to recognize championship with the August tournament. In September 92, which at the time really consisted of two promotions, NWA, the WCW and New Japan, Sakaguchi was named NWA president, and then Watts replaced Fry as vice president in October 92 in charge of wrestling operations, drafted a letter which was believed by NWA counsel to have been a bill of sale for the physical championship belt from the NWA to WCW for the $28,000 already paid by WCW, representing the NWA to Flair, which was signed by Sakaguchi as NWA president. Apparently, nobody from the NWA actually saw that letter or knew of its contents, other than it was known about a bill of sale letter, what had become in the industry as, quote, the Ric Flair championship belt, unquote, to WCW. What wasn't known was that letter written by Watts and signed by Sakaguchi also gave WCW all intellectual rights to use the name NWA. The NWA's counsel was first informed of the contents of the letter during this arguments Wednesday afternoon before U.S. District Judge Richard Voorhees for the restraining order against the match billed as a world title match. The letter was the key in the judge turning down the NWA's claim and allowing the match advertising of it as a world title match, and the scheduled result to all go on as planned. The only thing Voorhees ruled is that WCW would be prohibited from calling the match on the pay-per-view show as an NWA title match, which WCW wasn't going to do at this point anyway. The NWA members were scheduled to be discussing the situation later this week as to whether they will challenge the validity of the letter in court, since NWA attorneys claimed that the NWA bylaws specifically state any such transaction and the belt itself is controlled by the board of directors, which were never informed about nor approved the letter. However, with the exception of gaining possession of the Ric Flair belt, it is not known what could be gained. The title switch drew for what all wrestling fans will believe is the NWA Championship did take place on September 19th in Houston, although the initials NWA were never used on the broadcast. With virtually all wrestling fans watching the show, they believe they watched the NWA title match, and they have seen the title change. On the air, it simply referred to the World Heavyweight title, and presented as if it were a premier title promotion, since Vader's title was just called the WCW title, and downplayed heavily. Which reminds a lot of the old WWE World Heavyweight title.
I was just going to say, you sound familiar, huh?
Yeah. The result can't be erased in the minds of the wrestling fans who saw the match or eventually hear or read the result by virtue of the wrestling publications and wrestling television shows, even if an expensive court fight would wind up with a letter being overturned. The NWA can and will likely at some point name a new world champion, but the title in its initial stages will lack the credibility of the fans it would have if the champion won it from Roode or whomever, and that in-ring title switch isn't going to take place. Now, the Charlotte Business Journal, in an issue that came out prior to the pay-per-view, had an article about this legal fight over the title match, and it revealed the result of the match with Roode winning. I talked about the television had been the months back with Roode holding the belt and talking about his win over Flair. At least some NWA members were upset at information from this convention in regards to Road Warrior Hawk, Terry Funk, and Ted DiBiase being the three discussed as being recognized as the next NWA champion that was reported both here and the Pro Wrestling Torch. As was expected by many when those names went public, WCW reopened negotiations with both Hawk and Ted DiBiase during the week, which some within the NWA believe is largely based on knowledge they were being considered as champion. Hawk agreed to work several days in November, the TV tapings in Orlando, the 11-17 Clash for Tampa, and 11-20 Battle Bowl for Pensacola.
Also, Hawk had been advertised for Fall Brawl originally.
Yeah.
On the Babyface War Games team, and got replaced by Shockmaster, right?
And the Animal was at ringside. Reportedly, WCW will allow Hawk and Animal, whose business partnership breakup has been smoothed over by Minneapolis attorney Martin Levine, who is merchandising Road Warrior gimmicks, to maintain their merchandising rights and allow them advertising time in exchange for both men appearing on several shows. Animal still won't be wrestling, but will be appearing alongside Hulk on those shows as he did the recent Clash. DiBiase and WCW negotiated during the week, but negotiations broke off. DiBiase didn't get the money offer nor the number of dates he was after. The numbers we were given was that DiBiase wanted $100,000 to $125,000 for a 100-date deal, and WCW didn't want to make that commitment, which should tell you something about future contract negotiations with a lot of wrestlers, because there aren't a lot of DiBiase caliber performers in this country. He was also told his first match back would be a 30-minute draw with Dustin Rhodes in a U.S. title match at Halloween Havoc, which would replace Steve Austin, which apparently he didn't feel like was the appropriate way to begin with a new promotion. All right. That's a lot to digest there, folks.
Yes.
Keith, thoughts on the NWA and the, you know, did they have a leg to stand on this whole situation?
Well, I think obviously the deal where Bill Watts Bill Watts and Saichi Sakaguchi basically conspired to transfer all the rights of the name, the NWA name.
Well, I thought that was just the physical belt.
No, it was also the intellectual rights, wasn't it?
That's what I said. Yep. Intellectual rights to the name NWA.
Okay, I missed that part. This is very confusing.
Yeah.
So that is really underhanded, and I don't think that could stand up in court. I mean, I just think what a mess. What a waste of time. Like, surely they could have come up with some agreement that wouldn't have to see all these lawyers involved. I don't know why they just didn't say that, this on the pay-per-view broadcast, that this is the title isn't the NWA title anymore, but WCW was recognizing it as a new world title or something like that. I don't know
why. Which they ended up doing anyway.
Yeah.
The international heavyweight title.
No. Yeah. The WCW International World Heavyweight title. Yeah. No, it's not the same thing, because you have to remember, it is not an international title. It's the title recognized by WCW International, which was their fake NWA.
Yeah.
Yes. So they ended up doing it in the end anyway. So, I also think, though, that the NWA's demands were rather extortionate. I mean, I can understand...
Oh, of course!
I can understand the desire that they would want Rude to drop the title, drop the NWA title to, or Ric Flair or whoever, to drop the title to one, their chosen new champion. But it just wasn't going to happen, because you know how wrestling promotions are with these sorts of things.
Yeah.
And Big Sammy, I think there may have been some thought among the NWA brass that all Rude was going to do anyway was going to hot shot the belt over to Dustin Rhodes. And I don't think they wanted Dustin Rhodes as the champion.
Well, yeah, this was that period where you were hearing, like, every other week in The Observer that the plan eventually to unify the belts was that Dustin Rhodes would end up the unified champion, which never happened or anything close. He never won either title.
Well, Dustin got removed from Power.
Well, that too. But... yeah, and then, but the whole thing was just so weird in the first place. Like, I don't get why, this was, it was more useless than ever for that, until they got rid of the WCW International World title, but I don't get, in the first place, why did you bring back the NWA title if you weren't going to unify it? Because then they just, at least WWE was trying to have a second belt to carry a second touring brand. This was just...
I think Bill Watts was marking out over the name.
He was, but why didn't he... But he was in charge for a while, and he didn't really...
Yeah, and he was long gone by this time. I mean, they could have had... I think maybe they just wanted to have two world champions. They didn't want to job... they wanted to have Flair to have a title. And not the WCW title.
Oh, is that why they put it... You think that's why they put it on Wyndham in the first place, once they got control from New Japan?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Well, New Japan didn't want the belt on Wyndham. if I recall reading correctly.
Yeah.
So, because
he wasn't going was to
a big star. He wasn't. Also, he wasn't that big, that well known name in Japan, not at a world heavyweight title level.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole lot going on. But I think one thing we can agree on is the biggest loser in all this is Ted DiBiase, because he eventually got his career ended in Japan. If he had signed with WCW, who knows?
Well, was that a one match in like a acute injury, or was that just him taking all those doing all those crazy elbow drops onto his head and stuff?
Oh, I'm thinking that was that more that one match than anything else. I'm sure he probably had other things going on, but I mean, he never came back.
He took a lot of crazy bumps onto the back of his neck, though.
Yeah, but still, I mean,
more than most guys of his generation.
And I think that Ted DiBiase WCW would have been awesome. That's one thing I wish would have happened and never did, because that place suited him a whole lot more, and it was rumored to happen more than once that he wanted to go there. So,
how much was he making in All Japan?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I'm sure it was good money. I mean, they pushed him.
Oh yeah,
as
well, he was a
partner
big
right away.
Yeah, he was back as Hansen's partner again. But and isn't it funny how WCW, as soon as those names came out, you know, was in contract negotiations with him.
That's such a
More of a WWF-ish move than a WCW style.
And then once NWA, they had the tournament eventually. You know, of course, DiBiase was done, but
they had Hawk.
They had Hawk and then give him the belt. They have Funk off and on, then give him the belt. So, yeah.
And they had Funk was at ECW too at that point, and they didn't. I mean, and they didn't. Well, they didn't put him in the initial tournament with the.
But he was in WCW at the time too.
That's true. But then once he was done with WCW, they.
Yeah.
And he wasn't in ECW. They didn't even book him on that show.
No. So, NWA is just really weird. The whole NWA setup in the 90s. A lot of just weirdness.
And people do forget that they.
Well, Howard Brody's got that book about it. So.
Oh, yeah. Anyone who hasn't read that book, that's a great book, Swimming with Piranhas.
Really good.
And but people don't remember that, especially when Flair was in the mix, they promoted that the NWA title is much bigger than the WCW title.
Yes, and that's what I'm saying. It was like the opposite of WWE promoting the WWE title is more important than the world title.
Although they'd occasionally go in the opposite direction.
Yeah, depending on who the champion was, I guess.
But it was the Raw title was always the most important one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, going to WCW proper, there was a pay-per-view that we've talked about.
Not a good one.
Not a good one. And although I will say this, I was entertained by this show. I mean, like I said, it wasn't really good, but I was entertained by it. Now, the dark match, we had Eric Wasch going over Bobby Eaton. Which was a bad match, supposedly.
I forgot that Eric Watts was still around this late.
Yeah. Our first match was Lord Steven Regal beating Ricky Steamboat for the World TV title in 17 minutes, where Steamboat is selling his ribs when he got hurt on television. And this was not a very good match, considering who was in there.
No.
It was really disappointing.
I'm trying to remember, did they have any other matches together? At least on TV?
I think they had a TV.
Sure, they did.
But they just did not work as well together as you'd expect.
Yeah.
And
or hope for.
Yeah, definitely.
Now I'm trying to remember. Did they build this though as that the title would be on the line after the first 15 minutes? Because the TV title change after the 15 minute mark, and usually that they either had a 15 minute time limit or they do the thing where the title was only online in the first 15 minutes.
Yeah, I can't remember. And, of course, the match ended with Sir William building the knees in his umbrella. And then Regal hit a German suplex.
I never knew Bill Dundee was such a big Manosuke Ueda fan.
Yeah.
It was a great day, though, for the UK.
Oh, yes, that's right. It was a great day for the UK to win a big championship. And he was a great TV champion.
And Bill Dundee is Scottish. People forget that. He was born in Scotland.
Yeah.
He's one of your countrymen.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the next match was Charlie Norris against Big Sky.
Oh, good God almighty.
Terrible. Terrible match. The less we talk about it, the better.
If next Tyler match, Bean is the better worker in a match.
Yeah, Charlie Norris sucked. The clear Tatanka ripoff.
Although he has one of my... Well, no, he was around before Tatanka, or around the same time.
Yeah, but
they brought him in because he was a Native American.
Exactly.
But Charlie Norris has one of my favorite WCW racism lawsuit stories, where they wanted him to be more of a, quote, Indian. And he said that Greg Gagne was telling him to do a rain dance and then proceeded to do the dance in front of him to show him the way he wanted him to do a rain dance.
Hilarious.
That sounds very Michael Hayes-esque.
Well, we all know DeGagna's background with minorities, so...
Blacks can't draw in this territory, Chris.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. Now, our next match featured, speaking of blacks, Too Cold Scorpio and Marcus Bagwell going over the Equalizer, Yvette Sullivan, and Paul Orndorff, which is a makeshift tag team. And it was a crappy match. Scorpio and Bagwell won because they were getting a tag title match on Halloween Havoc. So, of course, in them getting that title shot, they get destroyed by the heels after the match. WCW, folks. All right, the next match. Ice Train goes over the legendary Shanghai Pierce.
Oh, my God.
Now, Thunderbolt Patterson... Thunderbolt Patterson was with Ice Train at this time, and this is like the beginning of Ice Train. And he was just not ready. It sucked dick. It wasn't Shanghai's fault.
I like the way they introduced Ice Train, though. Where they went to that indie show, and it was his farewell to the indies or whatever.
Yeah.
I like that. I thought that was a cool way to introduce him, but, it's rookie Ice Train. I mean, he never really got that good. I mean,
yeah. Now, WCW tag title match. The champions, Arn Anderson and Paul Roma. Of course, Paul Roma is still a member of the Horsemen. Going against the Nasty Boys, who had their big surprise, which was Missy Hyatt as their new manager.
Who had been with them at the Worldwide tapings, of course.
Yeah, and Dave Meltzer described as dressed like Kelly Bundy from Married with Children. Of course, she had the, leopard tights on or something like that.
And yeah, she had the Kelly Bundy type hair, shorter hair, too.
Yeah, at that time period.
Right.
Now, the thing I remember most about this match was the poster that said, "Hey, Missy, did you buy them?" Which Ventura was lost for, because he couldn't help himself. He just died laughing, and would then just try to do lines after lines to try to one-up the poster. So basically, this match went a long time, too. It went like 24 minutes almost.
Why were they booking the Nasties in all of these like 25, 30-minute matches around
and
this time?
And this was Arn Anderson and Paul Roma. So, I mean, it was a terrible match. And this one with Arn Anderson in it. Terrible match. But the highlight of it is Jesse and Tony, who they were always good together, but they had an interesting night on this show. But they made this match with the jokes. Yeah, I mean, that was classic stuff. Our next match featured Cactus Jack going over Yoshi Kwan, the great Chris Champion, in a little over 3 minutes. Now, before the match, they did a news piece video narrated by Chris Cruz, which went over the whole Cactus Jack deal where he, made up all the stuff about going to Cleveland, suffering the memory loss, was fake family and all this other stuff. And there's one problem, though. The video and audio were out of sync, which that's WCW. But Cactus was very over, though, when he came out. One of the biggest pops of the night. One problem, though. Yoshi Kwan had done two straight jobs over Johnny B. Badd on TBS before this match.
Well, it's a good thing the match only lasted 3.5 minutes.
Yes! Isn't it?
And again, now, this is when Cactus got the secret little bag back, right?
That yeah, never explained. That's right.
The bag. And what else? Now, isn't this also when Cactus does the promo before the match and they... This is right when Vader started with UWFI, and he calls him Big Van Vader, and they have to bleep it.
Yeah, because he couldn't use that name.
New Japan owned the name Big Van Vader.
Japan owned the name, and they had then been to court over that. So, yeah. Now, that's our next
great promo, by the way.
Well, that is off.
Well, because he's just shitting on the whole angle.
Yeah. And Babyface Cactus is great in this time period. He was finally turned babyface, and the fans were into him like a freight train. So, it's awesome. Now we get the Ric Flair match. Went over 30 minutes. So it was a, classic world title.
Only in that sense.
Yeah, because you would think now with these two in it, this should be a classic match. But Rude had a rough year. Now, he had some good stuff that year, but he was really hurt.
He was never the same, though, after that neck injury at the end of 92.
Yeah, he had a lot of problems. And Flair, they did try there towards the last part of the match. But the whole deal here, of course, this is like a homage to the Jake's wife deal, where Rude had Fifi on his tights. And Fifi, now she was not in her maid gear when she came out with Flair, wasn't she? Wasn't she like wearing her regular dress for this match?
Yes. And I think this is her last appearance too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's her last appearance. So, and of course, look at him now.
I almost forgot about that.
And now they're back. Now they're back together again because, of course, Fifi was Wendy Barlow, and they're back together again. And good luck to the young couple there. But
apparently, he's great with her kids.
Yeah, and Rick's been a lot better lately with her. So that's
good. Not if you listen to all of his podcasts.
Well, hey, Flair is going to Flair, but he's not too embarrassing. But anyway, this match, it's sad. And it was one of those dream matches that you wish you would have got a couple years earlier. And,
I think a lot of the blame was put on Rude for that match, but I think Flair also wasn't as good as he was the year before either. I think he definitely came into WCW with a lot of fanfare, but it quickly fizzled out. And he had a disappointing match with Barry Windham at the last pay-per-view as well.
Well, Windham had blown out his knee, though, so that I would put on Windham.
Okay, yeah.
And Flair and Rude had these problems too, but it was a style clash as far as working each other as well.
I was just about to say that as good as Rude had peaked at in 92, if he had worked with Flair, like Babyface Flair then, I think it would have been better than this, but I don't think it would have been that great. I think it still would have been disappointing for the city. Like, just the ways that they excelled, especially depending on how Flair decided to work the match, I don't think the style matchup is that great.
Yeah.
Totally agree. And the only way they could have done it is if Flair went into it with like a reverse Austin Idol deal where he did against Austin Idol, but of course those matches, Austin Idol was babyface.
Or if he worked like early 80s babyface Flair.
Yeah.
Like if he, because, after 85 it all changed. If he was going to be a babyface, he was playing off of the heel Flair spots.
Yeah, exactly. All right, and in the main event, in what was the worst War Games ever, Sting, Dustin Rhodes, Uncle Fred, the Shockmaster, and Davey Boy Smith.
Uncle Fred is the Shockmaster, for those who forgot about that.
Yeah, that's right. Went over Sid Vicious, Harlem Heat, which at this time were Kane and Cole, not Booker T and Stevie Ray, and Vader in the War Games. And the ending was Shockmaster made Cole submit to a bear hug, while Road Warrior Animal was in the corner of the babyfaces, for no other apparent reason other than he had been advertising the cable ads until the day of the show.
And of course, that was because of Hawk originally being advertised as the inside of the Shockmaster. And also, it was so weird that, people forget, Harlem Heat debuted on TV in the Shockmaster segment. They did not explain who these two guys were.
Yeah, and what Dave said, the finish epitomized the entire show. As Shockmaster grabbed Cole in a bear hug. Kane was right there looking at it and waiting for someone to stop him from making the save. It appeared that it was Smith's job, but he wasn't there. Kane just looked there like a guy who knew he was in a bad position and had no idea what to do, and looked and looked and looked until finally Smith grabbed him. Keith, did you watch this match last night in preparation for the show?
There was only clips on the 93 yearbook, thankfully. But
have you seen this before?
I have, yeah.
Oh, it's horrible.
My memory isn't that it wasn't that bad, in the sense that I thought Dustin versus Vader for the first 5 minutes was pretty good. And I think it was just, I would say it was a dull main event. And the finish, which I rewatched last night, it was just so anticlimactic. Like, you know, Shockmaster just tagged in, and within, you know, within a minute, he had put a bear hug on, and it was over. And it, you know, there was no fight, you know, there's no drama whatsoever.
Well, what hurts the match is you look at the 2 years before War Games, yeah, which were two of the all-timers, and then you follow this up with no blood.
Well, no, there was blood. There was blood. Dustin bladed, actually.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So there was blood, but not as much. I don't know if I would call this the worst War Games, because you had the Atrocity in 98 with the, you know, was it Ed Hogan's team and the Wolfpack team? And
well, this
Page's
was the worst
team.
One up to the point. This is the worst one up to that point. I'll be fair and say that, definitely. Yeah, you're right. The later ones were way worse.
Yeah, it depends on if you count 98 and 2000.
Yeah, of the glory days of War Games, this was the worst one.
And yeah, of the ones with the actual War Games rules, because you can kind of take out 98 and 2000 based on that. But
yeah,
the clear two worst of the real War Games are this and 95, by far.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you look at the talent in there, there's some really good guys, but oof. Yeah, it was just a bad show. Bad show. But they did 90 to 95,000 buys, which was about a 0.45, or a little more than a third of what SummerSlam was estimated at, which was 260,000 buys. Now, check this out. The Julio Cesar Chavez Pernell Whitaker fight, which is legendary, and I remember watching this live, did 1.1 million buys, which shows how wrestling standing in pay-per-view has dropped in comparison to boxing over the past few years. When WWF shows used to equal the big boxing matches, WCW wasn't that far behind. Yeah, boxing was big-time pay-per-view back then. It was now, too. But, I mean, yeah, Chavez Whitaker was a huge deal. And, yeah, and that was not too far before that. I want to say that was in August. I'm looking real quick. But, yeah, that was... This was an era where, I mean, even now you do pay-per-views that were close. Yeah, Whitaker Chavez on September 10th. So, a week, the weekend before. So you look at, I mean, you do pay-per-views that close together, even back then, it's going to affect, you know, people's money. Even though pay-per-views were cheaper in that era, but still. Just a sign that, you know, pay-per-view has its ups and downs, and now it's pretty much quote unquote dead in the wrestling world, but you know, whatever.
Well, that's only because they made it dead themselves. I mean, if they hadn't done the network, I imagine pay-per-view business would be doing better than it was.
Oh, of course. You know,
Lesnar versus Undertaker would have been the biggest SummerSlam pay-per-view for quite a while, several years at least.
Oh yeah. All right. Now, one WCW source told the Torch that Dusty Rhodes encouraged Astro Arena in Houston to be a location for Fall Brawl, so he could visit his mother, who lives in the Houston area, the weekend of the pay-per-view. Wasn't that nice, Dusty? And hey, you know, whatever.
Well,
it wasn't like they were drawing anywhere else heavily, so.
Well, I'm sure the person who told the Torch didn't mean it in such a flattering manner as Chris put it.
Yeah. Now, this is one of mine and Bix's favorites.
Someone speaking down to talking bad about Dusty to a wrestling newsletter writer? Really?
Never.
Where would you get such an idea?
Yeah. I don't
know. This is one of mine and Bix's favorite WCW stories. It was confirmed in the Taurus that WCW decided to rope off the section in front of the camera at center stage for only pay models, $25 and $50, and TBS personnel to sit to make the center stage look more aesthetic. The promotion was quote-unquote embarrassed with the composition of the crowd, a.k.a. meaning the crowd was too black. Yeah, center stage was in the area it said in Atlanta, you know, in southwest Atlanta, and that's a heavily urban section. Lots of black folks would go to center stage, and it gave it a great feel. I mean, it gave a great atmosphere.
There it is.
Definitely.
Whoop, there it is, and all that stuff. I mean, that got huge there. And people and groups like Harlem Heat was over mega there than anywhere else, and Scorpio, and Ron Simmons, but yeah.
Well, I mean, just in general, I mean, especially kids. Heavily black wrestling crowds are a lot of fun most of the time, and that's not a stereotype. Just in my experience, I think in yours too, they're usually more fun.
It's like going to a crowd, you know, that's like more Mexican. It's more fun. You know, they are in the minorities get into it more than most white people do. And it adds a flavor to the show. And I love going to those type of shows, you know? But center stage was, I mean, that was a complete joke when they started doing that. I mean, those tapings anyway were starting to get bad. Because at first, center stage was a pretty good spot in the early days. But the TV shows were starting to get bad. Everything was starting to get bad there.
And this is a company that had already been sued for racial discrimination at least twice, right? Ranger Ross and Thunderbolt Patterson. So, yeah. And it would happen many other times after this. And, you know, I'm not sure if that came up, now that I think about it. At least in the famous one, I don't think it came up. Not that I know of.
No.
That's kind of amazing, actually.
Yeah.
Although in his lawsuit, Stevie Ray did bring up the slave gimmick.
Yeah,
I would hope so.
Yeah, Harlem Heat being led around by chains.
And you were saying you were at that, right? Or were you at that one?
Yes, I remember that. That's pretty bad. Here's another great story. They had sold a show to Pace Entertainment, I guess based out of Dallas, at the 78,000-seat Texas Stadium in Irving, Texas, for November 17th. Okay? The show was canceled after only 35 tickets were sold.
Ooh.
I know they weren't going to go for a full 78,000 configuration, but Jesus Christ, 35 tickets.
How bad must the local promoter been? I mean, if you just sold tickets to your family and friends, surely you'd get more than 35 tickets sold.
Yeah.
And it's a sold show too. Now, I wonder, did WCW still get paid?
Oh, I'm pretty sure they did.
Well, good for them.
Yeah, definitely. You know, at least they got some money out of the deal. All right, another good story. WCW debuted at the Crystal Chandelier, which, by the way, I think is still open, in Kennesaw, Georgia on September 21st, drawing 42 fans at $5 a head. Now, they're supposed to run every week, mainly using it to give the training school guys some ring time. Now, here's your results. Jim Steele over the Gambler. Buddy Lee Parker over Bobby Walker.
Yes, Bobby Walker was around back then. And as a reminder, no, he's not Robbie Walker. Robbie Walker was a different person.
Lightning, if you remember the team of Thunder and Lightning, Lightning beat Big Bad John by DQ.
Now, wait a second. So was Lightning Jeff Farmer? Or was Thunder Jeff Farmer?
I can't remember. Tex Slashinger, Shanghai Pierce in your main event went over Keith Cole and Johnny B. Bad.
Go ahead.
Shows had Michael Hayes would work, Terry Taylor would work. I think Bill Dundee even worked as Bill Dundee on these shows. So they did it for a very short time, but it was a cool idea.
It was WCW developmental, sort of.
Yeah, it was their version of NXT, folks.
Not as successful.
So,
oh, not in the fourth.
Is this the big bad John that had been in Global the year before?
I have no idea.
I mean, it's like, I know there have been a plenty of big bad Johns in wrestling, but
yeah.
I don't know who else it would be, though, because I don't know who would have shown, because all these guys showed up in WCW except for him, I think.
Yeah.
And also, so was the power plant public at this point? I guess it was.
I don't know if it was or not.
Because, like, Bobby Walker, they signed and paid from the beginning, but I don't know about the other guys, like, I'm forgetting everyone's name all of a sudden. Who else was on the show? What did we just say? They didn't train Jim. Did Steel, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if they trained the Gambler. I guess Mero, they had trained themselves, right?
Yes.
Cole Twins, did they train?
No idea.
There were actually less trainees on this show. I mean, guys who started as trainees. Like, but I think some of these guys are guys who they signed to train at the school as prospects.
Yeah.
Now, we talked earlier about the quote-unquote WWF wrestling. Well, if you want to know how TV stations think of wrestling, consider this. KGSC, Channel 36 in San Jose, was listing WWF wrestling starting on September 18th at 11 p.m. However, nobody from WWF knew anything about it. A call to the station resulted in being told that it was WWF wrestling with Hulk Hogan. That would air, even though Hogan is no longer even with WWF. But later examination showed it was WCW Pro Wrestling. But the station rep said, we thought all wrestling was WWF wrestling with Hulk Hogan. WCW now has two syndicated shows in the San Francisco market, as they're on Channel 20 on Saturdays at 10 a.m., and both stations air WCW Pro. So the A show worldwide doesn't even air, probably because the brain surgeons don't even realize it's in the same market and figure San Jose is a suburb of Los Angeles, which already gets the worldwide show when the two scenes are about 330 miles apart. Oh, TV, Alex. WWF wrestling with Hulk Hogan.
Yeah. This type of stuff, I mean, this wasn't limited to wrestling, this type of thing happening, though. I mean, there would be weird stuff like this. I mean, it wasn't always on the TV station, and, like, I remember my dad worked for the company that did the revived version of the Phantom, from the futuristic one, Phantom 2040. And one week, there was, like, I want to say it was, like, a bigger-than-usual number, or it was in a market they didn't realize they were on in. And they looked, and it said Phantom. And they're like, huh? It turned out to be an infomercial for the Phantom vacuum cleaner.
Oh.
I don't remember if the part of it increasing the rating or whatever was accurate, but it sounds right that's why they noticed it. And But so it's not unusual for that type of thing to happen in TV. But I mean, it also reminds me of I think it was the following year when WWF got like a new announcer opening and closing the shows in Germany. And, like, it was this guy who was, like, just completely separate and talking down about the wrestling, like, calling it a male soap opera, just these weird things. I think implying that Shawn Michaels and Diesel were a gay couple and all sorts of stuff like that. He did, like, this for, like, 1 week, maybe 2 weeks in a row. The third one, all he said was, enjoy Hulk Hogan and friends. And then he was gone. I remember this was in the Torch. I need to find it because it's great. Because it had like a full translated thing of everything he said.
Hulk Hogan and friends. But the last note we have, and this is pretty interesting to read considering. Eric Bischoff, who was promoted from executive producer to senior vice president recently. Yeah, I mean, he was. It took a while for him to take over as the guy really in charge. And he said, right now he said to be overworked by WCW, which has created moodiness to the point that secretaries use hand signals to warn office personnel if he isn't approachable at the moment. He is not delegating a lot of his work and maybe trying to do too much. But there is no doubt on a day-to-day basis he is the boss. Ole Anderson is now working at the wrestling school helping his son, Bryant Rogowski, train for his debut and is no longer with the office. Dusty Rhodes, meanwhile, continues to be considered an egomaniac within the office and one who is willing to delegate work but not delegate credits. Yeah, that is the
I'm that's shocked.
The, yeah. I mean, Bischoff was in over his head at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe not the initial job as, you know, executive producer. Yeah. Once he got the promotion, that was probably a little too soon. Probably.
And that would have been a spot. I mean, if Terry Funk comes in as, you know, that guy, with Bischoff as executive producer of television, who knows?
Funk, I don't think, would have fit into the corporate environment, though.
Oh, no.
Of a similar problem with Bill Watts.
It wouldn't
be as bad as Bill Watts, I'm sure. But, yeah, could you imagine Terry Funk coming into work with a suit and tie every day? And I don't know.
Well, he'll wear that same tuxedo he wore for a pro.
Yeah.
Terry Funk?
And the tuxedo Terry Funk at Funk's Grill.
Would he be assisted by the Crispy Cruiser? Would he be his executive assistant?
Hey, Crispy Cruiser was there.
Yeah.
So anyway,
what was the story behind Ole Anderson being moved to the power plant? Because I know there's a story there. I don't know if this was what caught. I might be mixing stories up. I know there was a story where Ole Anderson mouthed off to Blackjack Mulligan, and he didn't realise that Blackjack Mulligan, Eric Bischoff, had given Blackjack Mulligan his job or something like that. And so, obviously, Blackjack Mulligan told Eric Bischoff that Ole Anderson had spouted off with him, so he got demoted. Or I'm not sure if that happened at the power plant, though. So I'm not sure whether that was the reason he eventually got fired or it was linked to this.
Here's the deal. They started working with Smoky Mountain Wrestling. I mean, well, Ole was want Bryant to go to Smoky Mountain Wrestling. And Ole did promos at the school for Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Bischoff happened to walk in that day.
Happened to, in quotes.
Yeah. Yes, this is right. Yeah, I remember.
Showed up and fired Ole for working with Cornette.
Okay, although Ole knew this would happen.
Yeah.
It's not like Ole.
And by the way,
surprised that he got fired.
Those Ole promos were awesome. The one Ole does from his yard. Oh my God. I mean, it is cranky old fucking Ole Anderson, and he's awesome in that role. And he's basically got their shooting, and it's awesome. But on that note, this has been a hell of a show. It's not our longest yet, though. So that's one thing you got going for you, Keith. You haven't broke the record yet. But
I can keep talking for another half an hour if you want.
I think we're good to go because we're taping this right now as the Ring of Honor pay-per-view is going on, and the All Night Express is back.
You mean as two pay-per-views are going on?
Well, that other show with Atlantis and Sombra is going on.
Yeah, that other show.
Yeah, which they've got me all pissed off. But anyway, Keith, go ahead and get your plugs in.
So, obviously, I write for CageSideSeats.com. So I encourage anyone listening to this to check the site out. Lots of great writers, you know, Gino Morosco, Sean Reuter, and Bill Hanstock being the leading other people there. I'm also doing a podcast with Alan Blackstock on Twitter of the Wrestling Eye podcast fame. We'll be talking the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, particularly the candidacy for Big Daddy.
Well, that's good. I mean, we need more of the British-centric talk, especially in the Hall of Fame section. So, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that one. All right, Bix, talk about your million places you're working for now.
Okay. As this week, I am writing various things at sescoops.com and MMA.
Is Al Isaacs paying you directly?
No, different site. That was Scoops Central.
Doesn't matter. Still Al Isaacs involved. As long as there's Scoops, there's Al Isaacs.
In spirit.
In spirit.
You know, got Figure Four Weekly at WrestlingObserver.com and my, a few of the daily updates each week. I've got, so when is the new, X the New Fighting Spirit comes out? I guess next week, since this is being released on Monday. Does that sound right? I think the first week of October sounds right. Yeah. With my WBF article finally, as well as a profile I did of Bill Apter in, you know, in anticipation of his book coming out. And, I think that's... Oh, I don't think I mentioned the Daily Dot thing I did about the guy who trolls Facebook, people who post ridiculous customer complaints on companies' Facebooks that he then replies to as, you know, customer service, wink-wink, or we hope that helps, or whatever. They have, did an article about that for Daily Dot that's up. Yeah, I guess that's it for right now.
That's a really hilarious article.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great.
And I think that's is it for now. I mean, I'd like to plug a podcast I do called Between the We have an idea of what we're doing next week, but we're not sure who the guest is going to be yet.
Yeah, we're working on that, because this could be a very interesting show.
It's probably I can say it right, because
We're looking at the earliest show.
We're looking at something around the mid-80s, if we can.
We're going way back. So be prepared for that. Exile on Bad Street. There should be some episodes coming after you hear this show, and then the days after. I won't go too far in depth with it, but it would be all Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame related. So there's two shows definitely booked. One show with one guest, got to find another guest. And then there's another show that I want to do, I got to find two guests for. So we're definitely, three shows I got booked. So yeah, I mean, it could be five shows coming between this date and early October. So a lot of audio from me coming soon. And of course, we do this show every week, every Monday. And as you listen to this, this is the same day as the reaction show for Night of Champions, also on the Place to Be Nation Network, which should be a blast. So be on the watch out for that. And on that note, like, thank Keith for being on this show. Always great to talk to you, and definitely have you back on in the future. Bix, of course.
That'd be great.
You're always a great co-pilot.
No, I'm and, not.
There you are.
There you are.
There you are. And we're getting close to that mark. But anyway, we hope you enjoyed this show tonight, and we wish you listen to all our shows. Go back in the archives. Now, I've had some people say that they're just now listening to the second and third shows of this series. So listen to all of them. Just because they may be older, don't mean their list's good. And,
no, we're not doing it. It's not like we're doing a current event show.
Exactly. This is not current events. This is old school stuff. So, it's awesome. Anyway, I've said enough. For everybody, this is Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.